Chapter 31. The Pale Queen. I'm numb with grief, unable to think of anything but how Sevro will react when he hears Ragnar has died. How my nieces and nephews will never braid another bow into the friendly giant's hair. Part of my soul has departed, and will never return. He was my protector. He gave so many strength. Now, without him, I cling to the back of a Valkyrie as her griffin rises away from the bloody snow. Even as we soar through the clouds on great beating wings, even as I see the Valkyrie spires for the first time, I feel no awe, just numbness. The spires are a twisting, vertiginous spine of mountain peaks, so ludicrous in their abrupt rise from the Arctic plains that only a maniacal gold at the controls of a Lovelock engine, with 50 years of tectonic manipulation and a solar system of resources, could conspire to create them. Probably just to see if they could. Dozens of stone spires weave together like spiteful lovers. Mist shrouding them. Griffins making nests on their peaks. Crows and eagles in the lower reaches. Upon a high rock wall, 7 skeletons hang from chains. The ice is stained with blood and the droppings of animals. This is the home of the only race to ever threaten gold. And we come stained in the blood of its banished prince. Sefi and her riders searched the crevasse in which Aja fell. They found nothing but boot prints. No body, no blood. Nothing to abate the rage that burns inside Sefi. I think she would have remained over her brother's body for hours more had they not heard drums beating in the distance. Eaters who had mustered greater strength and intended to challenge the Valkyrie for possession of the fallen gods. Wrath stained her face as she stood over Cassius, her axe in hand. He is one of the first golds she'll ever have seen without armor. Maybe the first aside from Mustang. And I think, stained with the blood of her brother, she would have killed him there on the snow. I know I would have let her, and so too would have Mustang. But she relented at the urging of her Valkyrie. Clicking her tongue to her riders, sheathing her axe, and signalling them to mount. Now Cassius is tied to the saddle of a Valkyrie to my right. The arrow missed his jugular, but death might come for him even without a kiss from Sefi's axe. We land in a high alcove, cut into the highest reach of a corkscrew spire. Slaves from enemy obsidian clans, eyes branded into blindness, receive our griffins, their faces painted yellow for cowardice. Iron doors groan shut behind, sealing us off from the wind. The riders jump from their saddles before we can land to help carry Ragnar away from us, deeper into the rock city. There's a commotion as several dozen armed warriors push their way into the griffin stable and confront Sefi. They gesture wildly at us, their accents thicker than the Nagal I learned with Mickey's uploads and my studies at the academy. But I understand enough to glean that the newer group of warriors is shouting that we should be in chains, and something about heretics. Sefi's women are shouting back, saying we are friends of Ragnar, and they point feverishly to the gold of our hair. They don't know how to treat us, or Cassius, who several of the warriors pull away from us like dogs fighting for scrap meat. The arrow is still in his neck, whites of his eyes huge. He reaches for me in terror as the obsidians drag him across the floor. His hand grasps mine, holds for a moment, and then he's gone down a torch-lit hall, borne away by 6 giants. The rest cluster around us, huge iron weapons in hand, the stink of their furs thick and nauseating, quieting only when an old, stout woman with a hand-shaped tattoo on her forehead pushes through their ranks to speak with Sefi. one of her mother's war chiefs. She gestures upward towards the ceiling with large hand motions.
What is she saying?
Holiday asks.
They're talking about Phobos. They see the lights from the battle. They think the gods are fighting. These ones think we should be prisoners, not guests,
Mustang says.
Let them take your weapons.
Like hell.
Holiday steps back with her rifle. I grab the barrel and push it down, handing them my razor.
This is bloody spectacular, she mutters.
They shackle our arms and legs with great iron manacles, taking care not to touch our skin or hair, and jerk us toward a tunnel by the spire's guards, away from Sephi's Valkyrie. But as we go, I catch sight of Sephi watching after us, a strange, conflicted look on her white face. After being dragged down several dozen dimly lit stairwells, we're shoved into a windowless cell of carved stone and stifling smoky air. Seal oil smoulders in iron braziers, stinging our eyes. I trip on a raised flagstone and fall to the floor. There, I slam my chains against the stone, feeling the anger, the helplessness, all the things happening so fast, whipping around me, so I can't tell which way's up. But I can think long enough to grasp the futility of my actions, my plans. Mustang and Holiday watch me in heavy silence. One day into my grand plan, and Ragnar is already dead. Mustang speaks more softly.
Are you all right?
What do you think? I ask bitterly. She says nothing in reply. Not the fragile sort of person to take offense and whimper out how she's just trying to help. She knows the pain of loss well enough. We need to have a plan, I say mechanically, trying to force Ragnar out of my mind.
Ragnar was our plan, Holiday says. He was the entire sodding plan.
We can salvage it.
And how the hell do you expect to do that?
Holiday asks.
We don't have weapons anymore, and they don't exactly look tickled pink to see us. They're probably going to eat us.
These ones aren't cannibals, Mustang says.
You're willing to bet your leg on that, Missy?
Alia is the key, I say. We can still convince her. It will be difficult without Ragnar, but that's the only way. Convince her that he died trying to bring their people the truth.
Didn't you hear him? He said words wouldn't work.
They still can.
Darrow, give yourself a moment, Mustang says.
A moment? My people are dying in orbit. Severo is at war, and he's depending on us to bring him an army. We don't have the luxury of taking a bloody damn moment.
Darrow,
Mustang tries to interrupt. I keep going, methodically sorting through the options, how we must hunt down Azure, rejoin with the Suns. She puts a hand on my arm.
Darrow, stop.
I falter, losing track of where I was, slipping away from the comfort of logic and falling straight into the emotion of it all. Ragnar's blood is under my nails. All he wanted was to come home to his people and lead them out of darkness, like he saw me doing with mine. I robbed him of that choice by leading the attack on Azure. I don't cry. There isn't time for it, but I sit there with my head in my hands. Mustang touches my shoulder.
He smiled in the end, she says softly. Do you know why? Because he knew what he was doing was right. He was fighting for love. You've made a family of your friends. You always have. It made Ragnar a better man to know you. So you didn't get him killed. You helped him live. But you have to live now.
She sits next to me.
I know you want to believe the best in people, but think how long it took for you to get through to Ragnar, to win over Tactus, or me. What can you do in a day? A week? This place. It's not our world. They don't care about our rules or our morality. We will die here if we do not escape.
You don't think Alia will listen?
Why would she? Obsidians only value strength. And where is ours?
Ragnar even thought he would have to kill his mother.
She won't listen. Do you know the word for surrender in Nagal? Ryoga.
The word for subjugation?
Ryoga.
What's the word for slavery?
Ryoga.
Without Ragnar to lead them, what do you think is going to happen if you release them on the society? Alia Snowsparrow is a black-blooded tyrant, and the rest of the war chiefs are no better. She might even be expecting us. Even if we've hacked the Gold's monitoring systems, the Golds know she's his mother, then they could have told her to expect him. She could be reporting to them right now. When I looked up at my father as a boy, I thought being a man was having control, being the master and commander of your own destiny. How could any boy know that freedom is lost the moment you become a man? Things start to count, to press in, constricting slowly, inevitably, creating a cage of inconveniences and duties and deadlines and failed plans and lost friends. I'm tired of people doubting, of people choosing to believe they know what is possible because of what has happened before. Holiday grunts. Escaping won't be that easy. Step one, Mustang says, as she slips free of her manacles. She used a little shard of bone to pick the lock.
Where'd you learn that?
Holiday asks. You think the Institute was my first school? She asks. Your turn. She reaches for my manacles. As I see it, we can rush them when they open the...
What's wrong?
I've pulled my hands back from her. I'm not leaving. Darrow, Ragnar was my friend. I told him I would help his people. I will not run to save myself. I will not let him die in vain. The only way out is through.
The Obsidians
are needed, I say. Without them, I can't fight Gold Legions. Not even with your help.
All right, Mustang says, not belaboring the point. Then how do you intend to change Alia's mind?
I think I need your help with that. Hours later, we are guided to the center of a cavernous throne room built for giants. It's lit by seal oil lamps that belch out black smoke along the walls. The iron doors slam shut behind us, and we're left alone before a throne, upon which sits the largest human being I've ever seen. She watches us from the far side of the room, more statue than woman. We approach awkwardly in our chains, boots over the slick black floor, till we come before Alia Snowsparrow, Queen of the Valkyrie. Across her lap lies the body of her dead son. Alia glares down at us. She is as colossal as Ragnar, but ancient and wicked, like the oldest tree of some primeval forest. The kind that drinks the soil and blocks the sun for lesser trees, and watches them wither and yellow and die, and does nothing but reach her branches higher and dig her roots deeper. The wind has armored her face in dead skin and calluses. Her hair is stringy and long, the color of dirty snow. She sits on a cushion of furs stacked inside the ribcage of the skeleton of what must have been the largest griffin ever carved. The griffin's head screams silently down at us from above her.
The wings spread against the stone wall, 10 meters across. On her head is a crown of black glass. At her feet is her fabled war chest, which is locked in times of peace by a great iron device. Her knotty hands are covered in blood. This is the primal realm, and though I would know what to say to a queen who sits upon a throne, I have no bloody damn clue what to say to a mother who sits with her own dead son in her lap and looks at me as though I am some worm that's just slithered up from the tiger. It seems she doesn't much care that I've lost my tongue. Hers is sharp enough.
There is a great heresy in our lands against the gods who ruled the thousand stars of the abyss.
Her voice rumbles like that of an old crocodile. But it is not her language. It is ours. Hylingo Oriat. A sacred tongue known by few in these lands, mostly the shaman who commune with the gods. Spies, in other words. Alia's fluency startles Mustang, but not me. I know how the low rise under the power of the mighty. And this merely confirms what I have long suspected. Slag and Gamma are not the only favored slaves of the worlds.
A heresy told by wicked prophets with wicked aims. For a summer and a winter it has slithered through us, poisoning my people and the people of the dragon spine and the blooded tents and the rattling caves, poisoning them with lies that spit in the eye of our people.
She leans down from her throne, blackheads huge on her nose, wrinkles deep ravines around pitch eyes.
Lies that say a stained son will return, and he will bring a man to guide us from this land. A morning star in the darkness. I have sought these heretics out to learn of their whispers, to see if the god spoke through them. They did not. Evil spoke through them. And so I have hunted the heretics, broken their bones with my own hands, peeled their flesh and set them upon the rock of the spires to be eaten as carrion by the fowl of the ice.
The 7 bodies who dangled from the chains outside. Ragnar's friends.
This I do for my people, because I love my people, because the children of my loins are few, and those of my heart many. For I knew the heresy to be a lie. Ragnar, blood of my blood, would never return. To return would mean the breaking of oaths to me, to his people, to the gods who watch over us from Asgard on high.
She looks down at her dead son.
And then I woke into this nightmare.
She closes her eyes, breathes deep, and opens them again.
Who are you to bring the corpse of my best-born to my spire?
My name is Darrow of Lycos, I say. This is Virginia Au Augustus and Holiday T. Nakamura. Alia's eyes ignore Holiday and twitch over to Mustang. Even at nearly 2 meters, she seems a child in this huge room. We came with Ragnar as a diplomatic mission on behalf of the Rising.
The Rising.
She dislikes the taste of the foreign word.
And who are you to my son?
She eyes my hair with more disdain than a mortal should have for a god. Something deeper is at play here.
Are you Ragnar's master?
I am his brother, I correct.
His brother?
She mocks the idea. Your son swore an oath of servitude to me when I took him from a gold. He offered me stains, and I offered him his freedom. Since then, he has been my brother.
He...
Her voice catches.
Died free?
The way she says it intones that deeper understanding. One Mustang notes. He did. His men, the ones you have hanged on the walls outside, would have told you that I led a rebellion against the Golds who rule over you, who took Ragnar from you, as they took your other children. And they would have told you, as well as all your people, that Ragnar was the greatest of my generals. He was a good man. He was...
I know my son,
she interrupts.
I swam with him in the ice floes when he was a boy. Taught him the names of the snow, of the storms, and took upon my griffin to show him the spine of the world. His hands clutched my hair and sang for joy as we rose through the clouds above. My son was without fear.
She remembers that day very differently than Ragnar did.
I know my son, and I do not need a stranger to tell me of his spirit.
Then you should ask yourself, Queen, what would make him return here? Mustang says. What would make him send his men here? If he would come here himself, if he knew it meant breaking his oath to you and your people. Alia does not speak as she examines Mustang with those hungry eyes.
Brother.
She mocks the word again, looking back to me.
I wonder, would you use brothers as you have used my son? Bringing him here, as if he is the key to unlocking the giants of the ice.
She looks around the hall so I see the deeds carved into the stone that stretches the height of 15 men above us. I've never met an obsidian artisan. They send us only their warriors.
As if you could use a mother's love against her. This is the way of men. I can smell your ambition, your plans. I do not know the abyss, O worldly warlord, but I know the ice. I know the serpents that slither in the hearts of men. I questioned the heretics myself. I know what you are. I know you descend from a lower creature than us. A red? I have seen reds. They are like children, little elves who live in the bones of the world. But you stole the body of an Aesir, of a sunborn. You call yourself a breaker of chains, but you are the maker of them. You wish to bind us to you, using our strength to make you great. Like every man.
She leans over my dead friend to leer at me, and I see what this woman respects. Why Ragnar believed he would have to kill her and take her throne. And why Mustang wanted to flee.
Strength.
And where is mine, she wonders. You know many things of him, Mustang says, but you know nothing of me, yet you insult me. Alia frowns. It's clear she has no idea who Mustang is, and no wish to anger a true gold, if, indeed, Mustang is one. Her confidence wavers only a fraction.
I have laid no claims against you, Sunborn.
But you have. By suggesting he has evil wishes in store for your people, you too suggest that I collude with him. That I, his companion, am here with the same wicked intentions.
Then what are your intentions? Why do you accompany this creature?
To see if he was worth following, Mustang says.
And is he?
I don't know yet. What I do know is that millions will follow him. Do you know that number? Can you even comprehend it, Alia?
I know the number.
You asked my intentions, Mustang says. I will put it plainly. I am a warlord and queen like you. My dominion is larger than you can comprehend. I have metal ships in the abyss that carry more men than you have ever seen, that can crack the highest mountain in two. And I am here to tell you that I am not a god. Those men and women on Asgard are not gods. They are flesh and blood, like you, like me. Alia rises slowly, bearing her huge son easily in her arms, and walks him to a stone altar and lays him upon it. She pours oil from a small urn onto a cloth and drapes it over Ragnar's face. Then she kisses the cloth, looking down at him. Mustang presses her. This land cannot hold seed. It is ruled by wind and ice and barren rock, but you survive. Cannibals roam the hills. Enemy clans ache for your land, but you survive. You sell your sons, your daughters to your gods, but you survive. Tell me, Alia, why? Why live when all you live for is to serve? To watch your family wither away? I've watched mine go. Each stolen from me, one by one. My world is broken. And so is yours. But if you join your arms with mine, with Darrow, as Ragnar wanted, we can make a new world. Alia turns back to us, beleaguered. Her steps are slow and measured as she comes before us.
Which would you fear more, Virginia Augustus? A god or a mortal with the power of a god?
The question hangs between them, creating a rift words cannot mend.
A god cannot die, so a god has no fear. But mortal men.
She clucks her tongue behind her stained teeth.
How frightened they are that the darkness will come. How horribly they will fight to stay in the light.
A corrupt voice chills my blood. She knows. Mustang and I realize it at the same terrible moment. Alia knows her gods are mortal. A new fear bubbles up from the deepest part of me. I'm a fool. We traveled all this distance to pull the wool from her eyes, but she's already seen the truth. Somehow.
Some way.
Did the golds come to her because she is queen? Did she discover it herself? Before she sold Ragnar? After? It's no matter. She's already resigned herself to this world, to the lie. There's another path, I say desperately, knowing that Alia made her judgment against us before we ever entered the room. Ragnar saw it. He saw a world where your people could leave the ice, where they could make their own destiny. Join me, and that world is possible. I will give you the means to take the power that will let you cross the stars like your ancestors, to walk unseen, to fly among the clouds on boots. You can live in the land of your choosing, where the wind is warm as flesh and the land is green instead of white. All you need to do is fight with me, like your son did.
No, little man. You cannot fight the sky. You cannot fight the river or the sea or the mountains. And you cannot fight the gods.
Alia says,
So I will do my duty. I will protect my people. I will send you to Asgard in chains. I will let the gods on high decide your fate. My people will live on. Sefi will inherit my throne, and I will bury my son in the ice from which he was born.
Chapter 32. No Man's Land. The sky is the color of blood underneath a dead nail as we fly away from the spires. This time we are imprisoned, chained belly down to the back of fetid fur saddles like luggage. My eyes water as the wind of the lower troposphere slashes into them. The griffin beats its wings, muscled shoulders rippling, churning the air. We bank sideways, and I see the riders tilting their masked faces up to the sky to see the faint light that is Phobos. Little flashes of white and yellow mar the darkening sky as ships overhead battle. I pray silently for Severo's safety, for Victra's and the Howlers. Words failed with Alia, as Mustang said they would. And now we are bound for Asgard, a gift for the gods to secure the future of her people. That is what she told Sefi, and her silent daughter took my chains and, with the help of Alia's personal guards, dragged me and Mustang and Holiday to the hangar where her Valkyrie waited. Now, hours later, we pass over a land created by wrathful gods in their youth. Dramatic and brutal, the Antarctic was designed as punishment and a test for the ancestors of the Obsidians who dared rise against the Golds in the 200th year of their reign. A place so savage, less than 60% of Obsidians reach adulthood, per Board of Quality quotas. That desperate struggle for life robs them of a chance for culture and societal progress, just as the nomadic tribes of the first Dark Ages were so robbed. Farmers make culture. Nomads make war. Subtle signs of life freckle the bald waste. Roving herds of auroch. Fires on mountain ridges, glittering from the cracks and the great doors of obsidian cities that are carved into the rock as they gather supplies and huddle behind their walls on the eve of the long dark of winter. We fly for hours. I fall in and out of sleep, body exhausted. Not having closed my eyes since we shared the pasta with Ragnar in our cozy hole in the belly of that dead ship. How has so much changed so quickly? I wake to the bellow of a horn. Ragnar is dead. It's the first thought in my head. I am no stranger waking to grief. Another horn echoes as Sefi's riders close their gaps, drifting together into tight formation. We rise amidst a sea of ash-grey clouds. Sefi bent over the reins in front of me, pushing her griffin hard toward a hulking darkness. We slip free of the clouds to find Asgard hanging in the twilight. It's a black mountain, ripped from the ground by the gods, and hung halfway between the abyss and the ice world below. Seat of the Aesir. Where Olympus was a bright celebration of the senses, this is a brooding threat to a conquered race. A set of stone stairs, precarious and seemingly unsupported, rises from the mountains, tethering Asgard to the world below. The Way of Stains. The path all young obsidian must take if they wish to gain the favor of the gods, to bring honor and bounty to their tribes by becoming the servants of All-Mother Death. Bodies litter the valley of the fallen beneath. Frozen mounds of men and women in a land where carrion never rots, and only the industry of crows can make proper skeletons. It is a lonely walk, and one we must make if the obsidian are to approach the mountain. This is what it takes to make an obsidian afraid. I feel that fear now from Sephi. She has never walked this path. No stained may stay among the people of the spires or the other tribes. All are chosen by the golds for service. Her mother would never have let her take the tests. She needed one daughter to remain as her heir. Unlike Olympus, Asgard is surrounded by defensive measures. Electronic high-pitched frequency emitters that would make the Griffin's eardrums bleed 2 clicks out. A high-charged pulse shield closer in that would hyper-oscillate the molecular structure of any man or creature by boiling the water in our skin and organs. Black magic to the obsidian. But the sensors are dead today. Compliments of Quicksilver and his hackers. And the cameras and drones that monitor our approach are blind to us, showing instead the footage recorded 3 years before, just as with the satellites. There is only one way to seek an audience with the gods, and that is along the Way of Stains, through the Shadowmouth Temple. We sat down atop the forbidding mountain peak beneath Asgard, where the Way of Stains is tethered to the earth. A black temple squats over the stairs like a possessive old crone, its skin ravaged by time, face crumbling to the wind. I'm pulled off the saddle and fall to the ice, legs asleep after the long journey. The Valkyrie wait for me to rise with Mustang's help. "I think it's time," she says. I nod and let the Valkyrie push us, after Sephi, toward the Black Temple. Wind pours through the mouths of 333 stone faces that scream out from the temple's front facade, imprisoned beneath the black rock, wild eyes desperate for release. We enter under the black arch. Snow rolls across the floor. "Sephi," I say. The woman turns slowly back to look at me. She's not cleaned her brother's blood from her hair. "May I speak to you? Alone." The Valkyrie wait for their quiet leader to nod before pulling Mustang and Holiday back. Sephi walks farther into the temple. I follow as best I can in my chains to a small courtyard open to the sky. I shiver at the cold. Sephi watches me there, in the weird violet light, waiting patiently for me to speak. It's the first time it's occurred to me that she's as curious of me as I am of her. And it also fills me with confidence. Those small dark eyes are inquisitive. They see the cracks in things, in men, in armor, in lies. Mustang was right about Alia. She would never listen. I suspected it before we entered her throne room, but I had to give it my best. And even if she had listened, Mustang would never trust Alia Snowsparrow to lead the obsidian in our war. I would have gained an ally and lost another. But Sephi. Sephi is the last hope I have. "Where do they go?" I ask her now. "Have you ever wondered? The men and women your clan gives to the gods. I don't think you believe what they tell you. That they are lifted up as warriors. That they are given untold riches in service of the immortals." I wait for her to reply. Of course she does not. If I can't sway her here, then we're as good as dead. But Mustang thinks, as do I, that we have a chance with her. More than we ever did with Alia, at least. If you believed in the gods, you would not have sworn yourself to silence when Ragnar ascended. Others cheered, but you wept. Because you know, don't you? I step closer to the woman. She's just above my own height. More muscular than Victra. Her pale face is nearly the same shade as her hair. You feel the dark truth in your heart. All who leave the ice become slaves. Her brow furrows. I try not to lose my momentum. Your brother was stained, a son of the spires. He was a titan, and he ascended to serve the gods, but was treated no better than a prized dog. They made him fight in pits, Sephi. They wagered on his life. Your brother, the one who taught you the names of the ice and wind, who's the greatest son of the spires in his generation, was another man's property. She looks up at the sky, where the stars blink through the black violet twilight. How many nights has she looked up and wondered what had become of her big brother? How many lies has she told herself so she can sleep at night? Now to know the horrors he suffered, it makes all those times she looked at the stars so much worse. Your mother was the one who sold him, I say, seizing the opportunity. She sold your sisters, brothers, your father. Everyone who has ever left has gone to slavery. Like my people. You know what the prophets your brother sent said. I was a slave, but I have risen against my masters. Your brother rose with me. Ragnar returned here to bring you with us, to bring your people out of bondage. And he died for it. For you. Do you trust him enough to believe his last words? Do you love him enough? She looks back to me, the whites of her eyes red with an anger that seems to have been long dormant, as if she's known of her mother's duplicity for years. I wonder what she's heard, listening for 2.5 decades. I wonder even if her mother has told her the truth. Sephi is to be queen. Perhaps that is the rite of passage, passing down the knowledge of their true condition. Perhaps Sephi even listened to our audience with Alia. Something in the way she watches me makes me believe this. Sephi, if you deliver me to the golds, their reign continues, and your brother will have sacrificed himself for nothing. If the world is as you like it, then do nothing. But if it is broken, if it is unjust, take a chance. Let me show you the secrets your mother has kept from you. Let me show you how mortal your gods are. Let me help you honor your brother. She stares at the snow as it drifts across the floor, lost in thought. Then, with a measured nod, she pulls an iron key from her riding cloak and steps toward me. The stairs of the Way of Stains are frigid and gusty and switch back devilishly into the sky through the clouds. But they are just stairs. We climb them without chains, in the guise of Valkyrie, bone riding masks painted blue, riding cloaks, and boots too big for my feet. All loaned to us by 3 women who stayed behind to guard the griffin at the base of the temple. Sephi leads us, 8 other Valkyrie coming behind. My legs shake from exertion by the time we reach the top and see the black glass complex of the golds that crests the floating mountain. There are 8 towers in all, each belonging to one of the gods. They surround the central building, a dark glass pyramid, like wheel spokes, connected by thin bridges 20 meters above the uneven snowy ground. Between us and the gold complex is a second temple, in the shape of a giant screaming face. This one as large as Castle Mars. In front of the temple lies a little square park, at the centre of which stands a gnarled black tree. Flames smoulder along its branches. White blossoms perch amidst the flames, untouched by the fire. The Valkyrie whisper to each other, fearing the magic at work. Seffi carefully plucks a blossom from the tree. The flames scorch the edges of her leather gloves, but she comes away with a small white flower the shape of a teardrop. When touched, it expands and darkens to the colour of blood, before wilting and turning to ash. I've never seen anything like it, nor do I particularly give a piss about the showmanship. It's too cold for that. A bloody red footprint blossoms in the snow in front of us. Seffi and her Valkyrie stay deathly still, arms outstretched with fingers crooked in a gesture of defence against evil spirits. It's just blood hidden in the stone, Mustang says. It's not real. Still, the Valkyrie are overawed when more footprints begin to appear on the ground, leading us toward the god's mouth. They look to each other in fear. Even Seffi goes to her knees when we reach the stairs at the base of the temple's mouth. We mimic her, pressing our noses to the stone as the throat opens, and out waddles a withered old man, beard white, eyes violet and milky with age.
"You are mad!" he howls. "Mad as crows to travel the stairs on the eve of winter!"
His staff thumps each individual step in his descent, voice squeezing the lines for all they're worth.
"Bone and frozen blood is all that should remain. Have you come to request a trial of the stains?"
"No," I rumble in my best Nagal. To take the trial of the stains now would do nothing for us. We would only see the gods when we received the facial tattoos. And surviving a test of the stained is something even Ragnar thought I was not prepared for. There's only one other way to bring the gods to me. Bait.
"No?"
the violet says, confused.
"We come to seek an audience with the gods."
At any moment, one of the Valkyrie could give us up. All it would take is a word. The tension works its way through my shoulders. Only thing that keeps me sane is knowing Mustang's on board enough with the plan to be bent on a knee beside me at the top of this damn mountain. That has to mean I'm not totally insane. At least I hope.
"So you are mad,"
the violet says, growing bored of us.
"The gods come and go, to the abyss, to the sea down below, but they give no audience to mortal men. For what is time to creatures such as them? Only the stained are worth their love. Only the stained can bear the fever of their sight. Only the children of ice and darkest night."
Well, this is bloody damn annoying.
"A ship of iron and star has fallen from the abyss," I say. "It came with a tail of fire, then struck among the peaks near the Valkyrie spires, burning across the sky like blood."
"A ship?"
the violet asks, now utterly interested, as we supposed he would be.
"One of iron and star," I say.
"How do you know it was no vision?"
the violet asks cleverly.
"We touched the iron with our own hands."
The violet is silent, mind sprinting to and fro behind those manic eyes. I'm wagering he knows that their communication systems are down, that his masters will be eager to hear of a fallen ship. The last sight he might have seen was my speech before Quicksilver shut everything down. Now this lowly violet, this eager actor, banished to the wastes to perform a mummer's farce for barbaric simpletons, as news his masters don't. He has a prize, and his eyes, when he realizes this, narrow greedily. Now is his time to seize initiative and gain favor in the eyes of the masters. How sad, the dependability of greed to make men fools.
"Have you evidence?" he asks eagerly. "Any man may say he has seen a ship of the gods fall."
Hesitating, fearful of the deception I work, but disdainful of priests, Sephi produces my razor from her bag. It is wrapped in sealskin. She lays it on the ground in whip form. The violet smiles, so very pleased. He tries to snatch it up from the ground with a rag from his pocket, but Sephi pulls it back with the seal cloth.
"This is for the gods," I growl. "Not their whelps."
Chapter 33. Gods and Men. The priest ushers us through the temple's mouth, where we wait, kneeling on the black stone antechamber inside the mountain. The stone mouth grinds closed behind us. Flames dance in the center of the room, leaping up in a pillar of fire to the onyx ceiling. Acolytes wander through the cavernous temple, chanting softly, draped with black sackcloth hoods.
"Children of the ice,"
a divine voice finally whispers from the darkness. A synthesizer, like the ones in our demon helms, layers the voice so it seems a dozen sewn together. The invisible gold woman doesn't even bother to use an accent. Fluent as I in their language, but disdainful of the fact, and of the people to which she speaks.
"You come with news?"
"I do, Sunborn."
"Tell us of the ship you saw,"
another voice says, this one a man. Less lofty, more playful.
"You may look upon my face, little child."
Remaining on our knees, we glance up furtively from the ground to see two armored golds deactivating their ghost cloaks. They stand close to us in the dark room. The temple flames dance over their metallic god faces. The man wears a cloak. The woman likely didn't have time to don hers, so eager were they to attend us. The woman plays Freya while the man is dressed as Loki, his metal visage like that of a wolf. Animals can smell fear. Men can't. But those who kill enough can feel the vibrations in that particular silence. I feel them now from Sephi. The gods are true, she's thinking. Ragnar was wrong. We were wrong. But she says nothing. "It bled fire across the sky," I murmur, head down, making great roars, and crashed upon the mountainside.
"You don't say,"
Loki murmurs.
"And is it in one piece, or lots of little itty-bitty pieces, child?"
It is risky saying we saw a ship fall, but I knew no other ruse that would draw the gulls away from their hollow screens in the middle of a rebellion, past the security systems and grey garrison to meet me here. They are peerless scarred, trapped here on the frontier as their world shifts beyond these walls. Once this post would have been considered glamorous, but now it's a form of banishment. I wonder about what crimes or failings brought these peerless scarred here to babysit the wastes.
"The bones of the ship litter the mountain, Sunborn," I explain, looking back at the ground so they do not insist I take away the riding mask that covers my face. The more groveling I do, the less curious I am. "Broken like a fishing boat, laid upon mid-stern by a breaker. Splinters of iron, splinters of men upon the snow."
I think that's a metaphor the obsidians would use. It passes muster.
"Splinters of men?" Loki asks. Yes, men, but with soft faces, like seal skin in firelight.
Too many metaphors.
But eyes like hot coals. I can't stop. How else did Ragnar speak? Hair like the gold of your face.
The gold's metal masks remain impassive, communicating to one another over the comms in their helmets.
Our priest claims you have a weapon of the gods,
Freya says leadingly. Sefi produces the seal cloth once more, body tense, wondering when I will dispel the magic of the gods as I promised. Her hands tremble. Both golds move closer, the slight ripple of pulse shields evident. I touch them and I fry. They have no fear, not here on their mountain.
Closer. Closer, you dumb bastards.
Why did you not take this to the leader of your tribe?
Loki asks.
Or to your shaman?
Freya adds suspiciously.
The way of stains is long and hard. To climb all this way just to bring this to us.
We are wanderers,
Mustang says, as Freya bends to look at the blade.
No tribe, no shaman.
Are you, little one?
Loki asks above Sefi, voice hardening.
Then why are there blue tattoos of the Valkyrie on the ankles of that one?
His hand drifts to the razor on his hip.
She was cast out from her tribe, I say, for breaking an oath.
Is it marked with a house sigil?
Loki asks Freya. She reaches for the weapon's hilt in front of me, when Mustang laughs bitterly, drawing her attention.
On the handle, my good lady, Mustang says in Oriat lingo, remaining on her knees as she strips off her mask and tosses it onto the ground. You will find a Pegasus in flight, sigil of the House Andromedus.
Augustus?
Loki sputters, knowing Mustang's face. I use their surprise and slip forward. By the time they turn back to me, I've snatched the razor out from under Freya's hand and activated the toggle so it is the curved question mark shape that has burned on hillsides, been cut into foreheads, and killed so many of their kind. The same they would have seen on the hollow displays, as I made my speech.
Reaper!
Freya manages, pulling up her pulse fist. I hack her arm off at the shoulder, then her head at the jaw before hurling my razor straight into Loki's chest. The blade slows as it hits his pulse shield, frozen in midair for half a second as the shield resists. Finally, the blade slips through, but it's slowed and the armor beneath holds. It embeds itself in the pulse armor plate, harmless, until Mustang steps forward and swivel kicks the hilt of the razor. The blade punches through the armor and impales Loki. Both guards fall. Freya to her back, Loki to his knees.
Mask off! Mustang barks as Loki's hands wrap around the blade sticking from his chest. She slaps his hand away from his datapad. No comms!
Holiday strips the razor from the man's hip as his pulse shield shorts. I take Freya's razor from her corpse.
Do it!
Sefi and her Valkyrie stare wide-eyed from their knees at the blood pooling beneath Freya. I remove Freya's helmet from her head to reveal the mangled face of a middle-aged, peerless, scarred woman with dark skin and almond-shaped eyes.
Does this look like a god to you, Sefi?
I ask. Mustang snorts a dark little laugh when Loki removes his mask.
Darrow, look who it is. Proctor Mercury.
The pudgy, cherub-faced, peerless scarred who endeavoured to recruit me into his own house at the Institute before Fichtner stole me away. When last we saw each other 5 years ago, he tried to duel me in the halls as my howler stormed Olympus. I shot him in the chest with a pulse fist. He smiled all the while. He's not smiling now as he stares at the metal in his chest. I feel a pang of pity.
Proctor Mercury, I say.
You have to be the least lucky gold I've ever met. Two mountains lost to a red.
Reaper! You have to be shitting me.
He shudders in pain and laughs at his own surprise.
But you're on Phobos.
Negative, my good man. That'd be my diminutive psychotic accomplice.
Gory damn it. Gory damn it.
He looks at the blade in his chest, grunting as he sits on his haunches and wheezes out breaths.
How did we not see you?
Quicksilver hacked your system, I say.
You're here for...
His voice trails away as he looks at the Valkyrie rising to gather around the dead god. Sephi bends over Freya. The pale warrior traces her fingers over the woman's face as Holiday strips off her armor. For them, I say. Bloody damn right I am.
Oh, gory hell. Augustus,
our old proctor says, turning to Mustang with a bitter laugh.
You can't do this. It's madness. They're monsters. You can't let them out. Do you know what will happen? Don't open Pandora's box.
If they are monsters, we should ask ourselves who made them that way. Mustang says in the obsidian tongue, so Sephi can understand. Now, what are the codes to Asgard's armory? He spits.
You'll have to ask nicer than that, traitor.
Mustang is deadly cold. Treason is a matter of the date, Proctor. Must I ask again, or must I begin trimming your ears? Beside Freya's body, Sephi dips her finger into the blood and tastes it. Just blood, I say, crouching beside her. Not ichor, not divine, human. I hold out Freya's razor for her to take. She flinches at the idea, but forces herself to wrap her fingers around the hilt, hand trembling, expecting to be struck by lightning or electrocuted like men are who touch pulse shields with bare hands. This button here retracts the whip. This one controls the shape. She cradles the weapon reverently and looks up at me, furious eyes asking which shape she should conjure. I nod to mine, trying to build kinship with her. And I do, if only in this martial way. Slowly, her razor takes the shape of the sling blade. The skin on my arm prickles as the Valkyrie laugh to one another. Vibrating with excitement, they pull their own axes and long knives and look at me and Mustang. There's five gods left, Mustang says. How'd you ladies like to meet them? Chapter 34 God Killers. We drag the bodies of seven gods, two dead and five captured, behind us. I wear the armor of Odin, Sephi the armor of Tyr, Mustang the armor of Freya, all of which we pillaged from the armory on Asgard. Blood smears the stone of the hall. Feet slide and stumble as Sephi jerks one of the living gulls behind us by his hair. Her Valkyrie dragged the rest. We returned to the spires on a shuttle stolen from Asgard, which we slipped through silently, using Loki's codes to access the armory and drape ourselves in the panoply of war before seeking the remaining gods out. Two we found in Asgard's mainframe, leading a team of greens attempting to purge Quicksilver's hackers from their system. Sephi, with her new razor, claimed the arm of one and beat the other unconscious, terrifying the greens, two of which held up fists to me as silent acknowledgement of their sympathy for the Rising. With their help, we locked the others in a storage room, as the two green sympathizers connected me directly with Quicksilver's operation room. We didn't reach Quicksilver himself, but Vitra relayed news that Severo's gamble worked. A little more than a third of the Martian defense fleet is under control of the Sons of Ares and Quicksilver's Blues. Thousands of the Society's best troops are trapped on Phobos, but the Jackal is hitting back hard, taking personal command of the remaining ships and recalling forces from the Kuiper Belt to reinforce his depleted fleet. The rest of the Golds we located through the station's biometric sensor map in the lower levels. One practicing with her razor in the training rooms. She saw my face and dropped her blade in surrender. Reputation is a fine thing sometimes. The remaining two Golds we found in the monitoring bays, shifting back and forth between the cameras. They'd only just discovered that the footage was archival from 3 years before. Now, all our Gold captives wear magnetic handcuffs and are tied together by long pieces of rope from Sephi's griffin, all gagged, all glancing around at the spires like we've dragged them into the mouth of hell itself. Obsidians of the spires flock to us in the halls, rushing from the deeper levels to see the strange sight. Most would only have seen their gods from a distance, as flashes of gold streaking over the spring snow at Mach 3. Now we come among them, our pulse shields distorting the air, our shuttle's pulse cannons melting open the huge iron doors which closed off the Griffin hangar from the cold. The doors melt inward like the door on the Pax melted when Ragnar offered me stains. This is not how I intended to bring the Obsidians into my fold. I wanted to use words, to come humbly, in sealskin, not armor, putting myself at the mercy of the Obsidians to show Alia that I valued her people's worth, valued their judgment, and was willing to put myself in peril for them. I wanted to do as I preached. But even Ragnar knew that was a fool's errand. And now I don't have time for intransigence or superstition. If Alia will not follow me to war, I'll drag her to it, kicking, screaming, like Lorn before her. For Obsidian to hear, I must speak in the only language they understand. Might. Sephi fires her pulse fist past my head at the doors leading to our mother's sanctuary. The ancient iron buckles, bent and twisted hinges screaming. We flow past an army of prostrate giants who clutter the cavernous halls to either side. So much strength made frail by superstition. Once, when they were stronger, they tried to cross the seas, built mighty canals to carry explorers across the oceans to seek out new lands. The carved monsters the gold sowed in the oceans destroyed each boat, or the golds themselves melted them from the sea. The last boat sailed more than 200 years ago. We come upon Alia as she sits in council with her famed 770 war chiefs. They turn to us now amidst large smoking braziers. Huge warriors with white hair to the waists, arms bare, iron buckles on waists, huge axes on backs. Black eyes and rings studded with precious metals glitter in the low light. But they're too stunned by the sight of the 300-year-old iron doors suddenly glowing orange and melting away to speak or kneel. I draw up before them, still dragging the corpses of the golds behind me. Mustang and Sephi hurl their captured golds forward, kicking out their legs. They sprawl on the ground and stumble to their feet, attempting beyond all reason to maintain some dignity here, surrounded by giant savages in the smoky room. Are these gods? I roar through my helmet. No one answers. Alia moves slowly through the parting warlords. Am I a god? I snarl, this time removing my helmet. Mustang and Sephi remove theirs, Alia sees her daughter in the armor of her gods, and she flinches back. Fear whispers over her lips. She stops near the five bound and gagged ghouls as they finally find their feet. They stand over 2 meters tall, but even bent and old as Alia is, she's a head taller than I. She stares down at the men and women who are once her gods, before looking up at her last daughter.
Child, what have you done?
Sephi says nothing, but the razor on her arm slithers, drawing the eyes of every obsidian. One of their greatest daughters carries the weapon of the gods. Queen of the Valkyrie, I say, as if we had never met. My name is Darrow of Lycos, blood brother of Ragnar Valaris. I am the warlord of the Rising, which rages against the false golden gods. You have all seen the fires that rage around the moon. Those are caused by my army. Beyond this land, in the abyss, a war rages between slaves and masters. I came here with the greatest son of the spires to bring the truth to your people. I wave to the golds, who stare at me with the hatred of an entire race. They struck him down before he could tell you that you are slaves. The prophets he sent told it true. Your gods are false.
Liar!
Someone screams. A shaman with crooked knees and a bent spine. He babbles something else, but Sephi cuts him off.
Liar! Mustang hisses. I have stood upon Asgard. I have seen where your immortals sleep. Where your immortals rot and eat and shit.
She twists the pulse fist in her hand.
This is not magic.
She activates her grav boots, floating in the air. The obsidians stare at her in wonder.
This is not magic. This is a tool.
Alia sees what I have done, what I have shown her daughter, and what I have now brought her people, whether she wants it or not. We're the same cruel kind. I told myself I would be better than this. I failed that promise. But noble vanity can shine another day. This is war, and victory is the only nobility. I think that is what Mustang was looking for here with obsidians. She was more afraid that I would allow my own idealism let something loose that I could not control. But now she sees the compromise I'm willing to make, the strength I'm willing to exert. That's what she wants in an ally as much as she wants a builder, someone wise enough to adapt. And Alia? She sees how her people look at me, how they look at my blade, still stained with the blood of the gods, as though it were some holy relic. And she also knows I could have made her complicit in the gold's crime, could have accused her before her people, but instead I offer her a chance to pretend she is just learning this for the first time. Lamentably, my friend's mother does not take the offer. She steps toward Sephi.
I carried you, birthed you, nursed you. And this is my reward? Treason? Blasphemy? You are no Valkyrie.
She looks at her people.
These are lies. Free our gods from the usurpers. Kill blasphemers. Kill them all.
But before the first war chief can even draw their blade, Sephi steps forward, lifts the razor I gave her, and decapitates her mother. Alia's head falls to the floor. Eyes still open. The woman's huge body remains standing. Slowly it tips backward and thuds to the ground. Sephi stands over the fallen queen and spits on the corpse. Turning back to her people, she speaks for the first time in 25 years.
She knew.
Her voice is deep and dangerous, hardly rising above the level of a whisper, yet it owns the room as surely as if she roared. Then tall Sephi turns away from the golds, walks back through the gaggle of war chiefs to the griffin throne, where her mother's fabled war chest has sat unopened for 10 years. There, she bends and takes the lock in her hands and roars gutturally, like a beast, as she pulls at the rusted iron till her fingers bleed and the iron crumbles apart. She throws the old lock to the ground and rips open the chest, pulling free the old black scarab skin her mother used to conquer the White Coast. Pulling free the red scale cloak of the dragon her mother slew in her youth, and hoisting high her great black double-headed axe of war called Throgmir. The rippling gleam of durosteel catches in the light. She stalks back to the golds, dragging the axe on the ground behind her. She motions to Holiday, who removes the gags from the mouths of the golds.
Are you a god?
Sephi asks, her tone so different from her brother's, direct and cold as a winter storm.
You will burn, mortal, the man says. If you do not release us, Aesir will come from the sky and rain fire upon your land. This you know. We will wipe your seed from the worlds. We will melt the ice. We are the mighty. We are the peerless Skard. And this millennium belongs to...
Sephi slays him there with one giant swing, cleaving him nearly in twain. Blood sprays my face. I do not flinch. I knew what would happen if I brought them here. I also know there's no way I could keep them as prisoners. The golds built this myth, but now it must die. Mustang moves closer to me, her sign that she accepts this, but her eyes are fixed on the golds. She will remember this slaughter for the rest of her life. It is her duty and mine to make it mean something. Part of me mourns the death of these golds. Even as they die, they make these other, taller mortals still seem so much lesser. They stand straight, proud. They do not quake in their last moment, in this smoky room so far from their estates, where they rode horses as children, and learned the poetry of Keats, and the wonder of Beethoven, and Vollmer. A middle-aged gold woman looks back at Mustang.
You let them do this to us.
I fought for your father.
I met you when you were a girl.
And I fell in his reign.
She glares at me and begins to recite with a loud, clear voice the Aeschylus poem the peerless Skard use at times as a battle cry.
Up and lead the dance of fate. Lift the song that mortals hate. Tell what rights are ours on earth, over all of human birth. Swift of foot to avenge are we, he whose hands are clean and pure. Naught our wrath to dread hath he.
One by one they fall to Sephi's axe, until only the woman is left, her head held high, her words ringing clear. She looks me in the eye, as sure of her right as I am of mine.
Sacrifice, obedience, prosperity.
Sephi's axe sweeps through the air, and the last god of Asgard flops to the stone floor. Over her body towers the blood-spattered princess of the Valkyrie, terrible and ancient with her justice. She bends and removes the tongue of the female gold with a crooked knife. Mustang shifts beside me in discomfort. Seffi smiles, noticing Mustang's unease, and walks away from us to her dead mother. She takes the woman's crown and ascends the steps to the throne, bloody axe in one hand, glass crown in the other, and sits inside the ribcage of the griffin, where she crowns herself.
Children of the spires, the Reaper has called us to join him in his war against false gods. Do the Valkyrie answer?
In reply, her Valkyrie raise their blue feathered axes high above their heads to drone out the obsidian chant of death. Even the war chiefs of fallen Alia join. It seems the ocean itself crashes through the stone hallways of the spires, and I feel the drums of war beating inside, chilling my blood.
Then ride, Hjelda, Tharul, Veni, and Hroga. Ride Faldir and Urona and Bolga to the tribes of the Blood Coast, to the Bleaking Moor, the Shattered Spine and the Witch Pass. Ride to kin and enemy alike and tell them Seffi speaks. Tell them Ragnar's prophets told true. Asgard has fallen. The gods are dead. The old oaths have been broken. And tell all who will hear, the Valkyrie ride to war.
As the world swirls around us, and the ecstasy of war fills the air, Mustang and I look at one another with darkened eyes and wonder just what we have unleashed. Part 3. Glory. All that we have is that shout into the wind, how we live, how we go, and how we stand before we fall. Carnus au Bellona. Chapter 35. The Light. For 7 days after the death of Ragnar, I travel across the ice with Seffi, speaking to the male tribes of the Broken Spine, to the blooded braves of the North Coast, to women who wear the horns of rams and stand watch over the Witch Pass. Flying in grav boots beside the Valkyrie, we come bringing the news of the fall of Asgard. It is dramatic. Seffi and a score of her Valkyrie have begun training with Holiday and me to learn to use the grav boots and pulse weapons. They're clumsy at first. One flew into the side of a mountain at Mach 2. But when 30 land with their headdresses kicking in the wind, the left of their faces painted with the blue handprint of Seffi the Quiet, and the right with the sling blade of the Reaper, folks tend to listen. We take the lion's share of obsidian leaders to the conquered mountain and let them walk the halls where their gods ate and slept and show them the cold, preserved corpses of the slain golds. In seeing their gods slain, most, even those who knew tacitly of their true condition as slaves, accepted our olive branch. Those who did not, who denounced us, were overcome by their own people. Two war chiefs hurled themselves from the mountain in shame. Another opened her veins with a dagger and bleeds out on the floor of the greenhouses. And one, a particularly psychotic little woman, watched with great malevolence as we took her to the mountain's data hub, where three greens informed her of a planned coup against her rule, showing her video of the conspiracy. We loaned her a razor, a flight back home, and 2 days later she added 20,000 warriors to my cause. Sometimes I encounter Ragnar's legend. It has spread among the tribes. They call him the Speaker, the one who came with truth, who brought the prophets and sacrificed his life for his people. But with my friend's legend grows my own. My sling blade symbol burns across the mountainsides to greet me and the Valkyrie when we fly to meet with new tribes. They call me the Morning Star. That star by which griffin riders and travellers navigate the wastes in the dark months of winter. The last star that disappears when daylight returns in the spring. It is my legend that begins to bind them, not their sense of kinship with one another. These clans have warred for generations, but I have no sordid history here. Unlike Sephi or the other great obsidian warlords, I am their untouched field of snow, their blank slate on which they can project whatever disparate dreams they have. As Mustang says, I am something new, and in this old world, steeped in legends, ancestors, and what came before, something new is something very special. Yet despite our progress with gathering the clans, the difficulty we face is massive. Not only must we keep the fractious obsidians from killing one another in honor duels, but many of the clans have accepted my invitation for relocation. Hundreds of thousands of them must be brought from their homes in the Antarctic to the tunnels of the Reds, so they are beyond the reach of gold bombardment, which will come when the Golds discover what has transpired here. All this while keeping the Jackal dumb and blind to our manoeuvres. From Asgard, Mustang has led the counterintelligence efforts, with the help of Quicksilver's hackers, to mask our presence and project reports consistent with those filed in previous weeks to the Board of Quality Control HQ in Aegea. With no way to move them without someone noticing, Mustang, a gold aristocrat, has conceived the most audacious plan in the history of the Sons of Ares. One massive troop movement, utilizing thousands of shuttles and freighters from Quicksilver's mercantile fleet and the Sons of Ares Navy, to move the population of the Pole in 12 hours. 1,000 ships skimming over the southern sea, burning helium, to set down on the ice before obsidian cities and lower their ramps to the hundreds and thousands of giants swaddled in fur and iron, who will fill their hulls with the old, the sick, the warriors, the children, and the fetid stink of animals. Then, under the cover of the Sons of Ares ships, the population will be dispersed underground, and many of the warriors to our military ships in orbit. I do not think I know another person in the worlds who can organize it as fast as she does. On the 8th day after the fall of Asgard, I depart with Sephi, Mustang, Holiday, and Cassius to join Sevro in overseeing the final preparations for the migration. The Valkyrie bring Ragnar with us on the flight, wrapping his frozen body in rough cloth and clutching him close in terror as our ship cruises just beneath the speed of sound, 5 meters from the surface of the ocean. They watch in awe as we enter the tunnels of Mars through one of the many sun's subterranean access points. This one, an old mining colony in a southern mountain range. Sun's lookouts in heavy winter jackets and balaclavas salute with their fists in the air as we pass into the tunnel. 30 days of subterranean flying later, we arrive at Tinos. It is a hub of ship activity, hundreds cluttering the stalactite docks, taxiing through the air, and it seems the whole city watches our shuttle as it passes through the traffic to land in its stalactite hangar, knowing it bears not just me and our new obsidian allies, but the broken shield of Tinos. Their weeping faces blur past. Already rumors swirl through the refugees. The obsidians are coming, not just to fight, but to live in Tinos, to eat their food, to share their already crowded streets. Dancer says the place is a powder keg about to erupt. I can't say I disagree. The disposition of the Sons of Ares is dour. They gather in silence as my ship's landing ramp unfurls. I go first down the ramp. Sevro waits beside Dancer and Mickey. He slams me into a hug. The beginnings of a goatee mark his stoic face. He holds his shoulders as square as he can, as if those bony things alone could hold up the hopes of the thousands of Sons of Ares who fill the docking bay to see the shield of Tinos brought back to his adopted home.
Where is he?
Severo asks thickly. I look back into my shuttle as Sephi and her Valkyrie carry Ragnar down the ramp. The Howlers are the first to greet them, Clown saying a respectful word to Sephi as Severo steps past me to stand before the Valkyrie.
Welcome to Tinos, he says to the Valkyrie in Nagal. I am Severo Aubarka, blood brother to Ragnar Valaris. These are his other brothers and sisters.
He motions to the Howlers, all of whom wear their wolf cloaks. Severo produces Ragnar's bear cloak.
He wore this to battle. With your permission, I'd like him to wear it now.
You were brother to Ragnar. You are brother to me,
Sephi says. She clicks her tongue, and her Valkyrie pass stewardship of her brother's body to Severo. Mustang glances my way. Sephi's generosity strikes me as a promising sign. If she were a covetous creature, she would have kept his body in her lands and given him an obsidian funeral pyre before burying his ashes in the ice. Instead, she told me she knows where his true home lies, with those who fought beside him, who helped him come back to his people. Mustang moves closer beside me as the Howlers drape Ragnar's cloak over his body and carry him through the crowd. The suns part for them, hands reach to touch Ragnar.
Look, Mustang says, nodding to the thin black ribbons that the suns have tied into their beards and hair.
Her hand finds my smallest finger. A small squeeze sends me back to the woods where she saved me, making me feel warm, even as we watch Severo leave the hangar with Ragnar's body.
Go. She nudges me his direction. Dancer and I have a conference scheduled with Quicksilver and Victra.
She needs a guard, I tell Dancer. Sons you trust.
I'll be fine,
Mustang says, rolling her eyes. I survived the obsidians.
She'll have the pit vipers, Dancer says.
Examining Mustang without the kindness I'm used to seeing in his eyes. Ragnar's death has taken the spirit out of him today. He seems older as he waves Nair all over and nods to the shuttle.
The Bellona on board?
Holiday's got him in the passenger cabin.
His neck's still torn up, so he'll need Virini to take a look at him.
Be discreet about it. Give him a private room.
Private? Place is crammed, Darrow. Captains don't even get private rooms.
He's got intel.
You want him shot before he can give it to us? I ask.
Is that why you kept him alive?
Dancer looks at Mustang skeptically, as if she's already compromising my decisions. Little does he know, she'd have let Cassius die more readily than I ever would. Dancer sighs when I don't relent.
He'll be safe. On my word.
Find me later, Mustang says, as I depart.
I find Severo slumped over Ragnar in Mickey's laboratory.
It's a thing to hear of a friend's death. It's another to see the shadow of what they've left behind.
I hated the sight of my father's old work gloves after he died. Mother was too practical to throw them away, said we couldn't afford to. So I did it myself one day, and she boxed my ears and made me bring them back. The scent of death is growing stronger from Ragnar. The cold preserved him in his native land, but Tinos has been suffering power outages and refrigeration units play second zither to the water purifiers and air reclamation systems in the city beneath. Soon Mickey will embalm him and make preparations for the burial Ragnar asked for. I sit in silence for half an hour, waiting for Severo to speak. I don't want to be here. Don't want to see Ragnar dead. Don't want to linger in the sadness. Yet I stay for Severo.
My armpits stink. I'm tired. The scanty tray of food Dio brought me is untouched, except the biscuit I chew numbly, and think how ridiculous Ragnar looks on the table. He's too big for it, feet hanging off the edge. Despite the smell, Ragnar is peaceful in death. Ribbons red as winter berries nestled in the white of his beard. Two razors rest in his hands, which are folded across his bare chest. The tattoos are darker in death, covering his arms, his chest and neck. The matching skull he gave me and Severo seems so sad, telling its story, even though the man who wears it is dead. Everything is more vivid except the wound. It's innocuous and thin as a snake's smile along his side. The holes Aja made in his stomach seem so small. How could such little things take so large a soul from this world? I wish he were here. The people need him more than ever. Severo's eyes are glassy, and his fingers glide over the tattoos on Ragnar's white face. He wanted to go to Venus, you know, he murmurs, voice soft as a child's, softer than I've ever heard it before. I showed him one of the holovids of a catamaran there. Second he put the goggles on, I'd never seen anyone smile like that. Like he'd found heaven and realized he didn't have to die to go there. He'd sneak in and borrow my holo gear in the middle of the night till one day I just gave him the damn thing. Things are 400 credits max. Know what he did to repay me? I don't. Severo holds up his right hand to show me his skull tattoo. He made me his brother. He gives Ragnar a slow, affectionate punch to the jaw. But the big fat idiot had to run at Aja instead of away from her. The Valkyries still scour the wastes in vain for signs of the Olympic night. Her trail goes deeper into the crevasse before it is covered by the frozen black blood of some creature. I hope something found her and took her to its cave in the ice to finish her slowly. But I doubt it. A woman like that doesn't just fade. Whatever Aja's fate, if she's alive, she'll find a way to contact the Sovereign or the Jackal. It was my fault, I say. My shit plan to take Aja out. She killed Quinn. Helped kill my father, Severo mutters. Killed dozens of us when you were locked up. Wasn't your bad. You'd have lost me too, if I were there. Even Rags couldn't have kept me from having a go at her. Severo rolls his knuckles along the edge of the table, leaving little white creases in the skin. Always trying to protect us. The shield of Tinos, I say. The shield of Tinos. He echoes, voice catching. He loved the name. I know. I think he'd always thought himself a blade before he met us. We let him be what he wanted. A protector. He wipes his eyes and backs away from Ragnar. Anyway, the little princeling is alive. I nod. We brought him on the shuttle. Pity. 2 millimeters. He pinches his fingers together, illustrating how narrowly Mustang's arrow missed Cassius's jugular. After Sephi dispatched riders to the tribes, I took her and many of her warriors to Asgard aboard the shuttle to see the fortress there. I brought Cassius along as well, and Asgard's yellows saved his life. Why are you keeping him alive, Darrow? If you think he's going to thank you for your generosity, you've got another thing coming. I couldn't just let him die. He killed my father. I know. Give me a reason. Maybe I think the world would be a better place with him in it. I say tentatively. So many people have used him, lied to him, betrayed him. All that's defined him. It's not fair. I want him to have a chance to decide for himself what kind of person he wants to be.
None of us get to be what we want to be,
Several mutters. At least not for long.
Isn't that why we fight? Isn't that what you just said about Ragnar? He was made a blade, but we gave him a chance to be a shield. Cassius deserves that same chance.
Shithead.
He rolls his eyes. Just because you're right doesn't mean you're right. Anyway, eagles are hated as much as the lions. Someone here is still going to try to pop him. And your girl, too.
She's got the pit vipers with her.
And she's not my girl.
Whatever you say.
He collapses into one of Mickey's stolen leather chairs and rubs a hand along his mohawk's ridge.
Wish she'd taken the telemanuses with her. If she had, you'd have slagged Aja hard.
He closed his eyes and leans his head back.
Oh, hey! He remembers suddenly. I got you some ships.
I saw that.
Thank you, I say.
Finally!
He snorts a laugh.
A sign we're making a difference. 20 torchships, 10 frigates, 4 destroyers, a dreadnought.
You should have seen it, Reap. Martian Navy pumped Phobos full of legionnaires, emptied their ships, and we just stole their assault shuttles, flew them back with the right codes, and landed them in their hangars. My squad didn't even fire a shot.
Quicksilver's boys even hacked the PA systems and the Navy ships. They all heard your speech. It was mutiny almost before we got on board. Reds, oranges, blues, even greys.
It won't work again, the PA system bit. Golds will learn to cut themselves off the network so we can't hack in. But it got him hard this week.
When we reunite with the Pax and Orion's other ships, we'll have a real force to slag the pixies.
It's moments like this that I know I'm not alone. Damn the world, so long as I have my mangy little guardian angel. If only I was so good at guarding him as he is at guarding me. Once again, he's done all I could ask, and more.
As I marshaled the obsidians, he ripped a gaping hole in the Jackal's defense fleet, crippled a fourth of them, forced the rest to retreat toward the outer moon of Deimos to regroup with the Jackal's reserves and await additional reinforcements from Ceres and the Khan. For a brief hour, he held naval supremacy over all of Mars's southern hemisphere. The Goblin King. Then he was forced to retreat to hunker close into Phobos, where his men eliminated the trapped loyalist marines by using Rolo's squads to cut off their air and vent them into space.
I'm under no delusion. The Jackal won't let us have the moon. He might not care about its people, but he can't destroy the station's helium refineries. So another assault will come soon. It won't affect my war effort, but the Jackal will get tied down fighting the populace that we've woken. It'll drain his resources without trapping me. Worst possible situation for him.
What are you thinking? I ask Severo. His eyes are lost in the ceiling.
I'm wondering how long till it's us on the slab. And wondering why it's got to be us on the line. You see vids and hear stories and you think of the regular people. The ones who got a chance at life on Ganymede or Earth or Luna. Can't help but be jealous.
You don't think you've gotten a chance to live? I ask.
Not proper, he says.
What's proper? I ask.
He crosses his arms like he's a kid in a fort, looking down at the real world and wondering why it can't be as magical as he is.
I don't know. Something far away from being a peerless scarred. Maybe a pixie, or even a happy mid-colour.
I just want something to look at and say, that's safe. That's mine. And no one is going to try and take it.
A house. Kids.
kids? I ask. I don't know. I never thought of it till Pops died. Till they took you. Till Victra, you mean? I say with a wink. Nice goatee, by the way. Shut up, he says. Have you two... He cuts me off, changing the subject. But it'd be nice to just be Severo. To have Pops. To have known my mother. He laughs at himself, harder than he should. Sometimes I think about going back to the beginning and wondering what would have happened if Pops had known the board was coming, if he'd escaped with my mother, with me. I nod. I always think about how life would have been like if Io never died. The children I would have had, what I would have named them. I smile distantly. I would have grown old, watched Io grow old, and I would have loved her more with each new scar, with each new year, even as she'd learned to despise our small life. I would have said farewell to my mother, maybe my brother, sister, and if I was lucky, one day, when Io's hair turned grey, before it began to fall out and she began to cough, I would hear the shift of rocks over my head on the drill. And that would be it. She would have sent me to the incinerators and sprinkled my ashes. Then our children would have done the same. And the clans would say we were happy and good and raised bloody damn fine children. And when those children died, our memory would fade. And when their children died, it would be swept away, like the dust we become, down and away to the long tunnels. It would have been a small life, I say with a shrug, but I would have liked it. And every day I ask myself, if I was given the chance to go back, to be blind, to have all that back, would I? And what's the answer? All this time I thought this was for Io. I drove straight on like an arrow because I had that one perfect idea in my head. She wanted this. I loved her, so I'll make her dream real. But that's bullshit. I was living half a bloody damn life, making an idol out of a woman, making her a martyr, something instead of someone, pretending she was perfect. I run my hand through my greasy hair. She wouldn't have wanted that. And when I looked out at the hollows, I just knew. I mean, I guess I realized, as I was talking, that justice isn't about fixing the past. It's about fixing the future. We're not fighting for the dead. We're fighting for the living. And for those who aren't yet born. For a chance to have children. That's what has to come after this. Otherwise, what's the point? Severo sits silently, thinking over what I've said. You and I keep looking for light in the darkness, expecting it to appear. But it already has. I touch his shoulder. We're it, boyo. Broken and cracked and stupid as we are, we're the light, and we're spreading. Chapter 36 Swill. I run into Victra in the hall as I leave Severo with Ragnar. It's late, past midnight, and she's only just arrived to help coordinate the final preparations between Quicksilver Security, the Suns, and our new Navy, which I've given her command of until we're reunited with Orion. It's another decision that peeves Dancer. He's frightened I'm bestowing too much power on Golds who might have ulterior motives. Mustang's presence could be the straw that breaks the camel's back. How's he doing? Victra asks regarding Severo. Better, I say.
But he'll be glad to see you.
She smiles at that, despite herself, and I think she actually blushes. It's a new look for her.
Where are you going?
She asks.
To make sure Mustang and Dancer haven't torn each other's heads off yet.
Noble, but too late.
What happened? Is everything prime?
That's relative, I suppose.
Dancer's in the war room, ranting about gold superiority complexes, arrogance, etc. Never heard him curse so much.
I didn't stay long, and he didn't say much. You know, he's not that sweet on me.
And you're not that sweet on Mustang, I say.
I have nothing against the girl. She reminds me of home, especially considering the new allies you've brought us. I just think she's a duplicitous little filly, that's all.
But it's the best horses that'll buck you right off, don't you think? I laugh. Not sure if that was innuendo or not.
It was.
Do you know where she is?
Victra makes a sad little face.
Contrary to popular opinion, I don't know everything, darling.
She moves past me to join Sevra, patting my head as she goes.
But I'd check the commissary on level 3 if I were you.
Where are you going? I ask.
She smiles mischievously.
Mind your own business.
I find Mustang in the commissary, hunched over a metal bottle with Uncle Nero, Kallax and Daxo. A dozen members of the Pit Vipers lounge at the other tables, smoking burners and eavesdropping intently to Mustang, who sits with her boots up on the table, using Daxo as a backrest, as she tells a story about the Institute to the other two occupants of the table. I couldn't see them when I first entered, due to the bulk of the telemanuses, but my brother and mother sit listening to the tale. And so, of course, I shout for Pax.
That's my son, Kavix reminds my mother.
And he comes on over the hill, leading a column of my house members.
Darrow and Cassius feel the ground shaking and go screaming into the lock where they clung together for hours, shivering and turning blue.
Blue,
Kavix says, with a huge childish laugh that makes the sons eavesdropping unable to keep their composure. Even if he's a gold, it's difficult not to like Kavix, our Telemanus.
Blue as blueberries, Sophocles. Isn't that right? Give him another, Diana.
My mother rolls a jelly bean across the table to Sophocles, who waits eagerly beside the bottle to gobble it up.
What's going on here? I ask,
eyeing the bottle my brother's refilling the gold's mugs with.
We're getting stories from the lass,
Nero says gruffly through a cloud of burner smoke.
Have a dram.
Mustang wrinkles her nose at the smoke.
Such an awful habit, Nero, she says.
Kirin looks pointedly at our mother.
I've been telling both of them that for years.
Hello, Darrow,
Daxo says, standing to clasp my arm.
Pleasure to see you without a razor in your hand this time.
He pokes me in the shoulder with a long finger.
Daxo, sorry about all that. I think I owe you a bit of a debt for taking care of my people.
Orion did most of the minding there, he says with a twinkle in his eye. He returns gracefully to his seat. My brother's captivated by the man and the angels tattooed on his head. And how could he not be? Daxos twice his weight, immaculate, and more well-mannered than even a rose like Mateo, who I hear is recovering well on one of Quicksilver's ships, and is delighted to know I'm alive.
What happened with Dancer? I ask Mustang.
Her cheeks are flushed, and she laughs at the question.
Well, I don't think he very much likes me. But don't worry, he'll come around.
Are you drunk?
I ask with a laugh.
A little. Catch up.
She swivels her legs down and puts her feet on the ground to clear a space on the bench beside her.
I was just getting to the part where you wrestled Pax in the mud.
My mother watches me quietly, a little smile on her lips
as she knows the panic that must be going through me right now. Too shocked at seeing two halves of my life collide without my supervision, I sit down uneasily and listen to Mustang finish the story. With all that's transpired, I'd forgotten the charm of this woman, her easy, light nature, how she draws others in by making them feel important, by saying their names and letting them feel seen. She holds my uncle and brother in a spell, one reinforced by the Telemannus' admiration for her. I try not to blush when my mother catches me admiring Mustang. "But enough of the Institute," Mustang says, after she's explained in detail how Pax and I duelled in front of her castle. "Diana, you promised me a story about Darrow as a boy."
"How about the gas pocket one?" Nerol says. "If only Lauren was here."
"No, not that one," Kieran says. "What about..."
"I have one," Mother says, cutting off the men.
She begins slow, words sluggish through the lisp.
"When Darrow was small, maybe 3 or 4, his father gave him an old watch his father had given him. This brass thing, with a wheel instead of digital numbers. Do you remember it?"
I nod.
"It was beautiful. Your favourite possession. And years later, after his father had died, Kieran here got sick with a cough. Meds were always in short ration in the mines, so you'd have to get them from Gamma or Grey. But each has a price. I didn't know how I was going to pay. And then Darrow comes home one day with the medicine. Won't say how he got it. But several weeks later, I saw one of the Greys checking the time with that old watch."
I look at my hands, but I feel Mustang's eyes on me.
"I think it's time for bed," Mother says.
Nerol and Kieran protest until she clears her throat and stands. She kisses me on the head, lingering longer than she usually would. Then she touches Mustang's shoulder and limps from the room with my brother's help. Nerol's men go with them.
"She's a quiet woman," Kavak says, "and she loves you very much."
"I'm glad you met like this," I say to him. Then to Mustang, "especially you."
"How's that?" she asks,
without me trying to control it, like last time. "Yes, I would say that was quite the disaster," Daxo says.
"This feels right," I say.
"I agree. It does."
Mustang smiles. "I wish I could introduce you to mine. You would have liked her better than my father." I return the smile, wondering what this is between us, dreading the idea of having to define it. There's an easiness that comes with being around her, but I'm afraid to ask her what she's thinking, afraid to broach the subject for fear of shattering this little illusion of peace. Kavax awkwardly clears his throat, dissolving the moment.
"So the meeting with Dancer didn't go well?" I ask.
"I fear not," Daxo says. "The resentment he harbours runs deep. Theodora was more forthcoming, but Dancer was intransigent. Militantly so."
"He's a cipher," Mustang clarifies, taking another drink and wincing at the quality of proof. "Hoarding information from us. Wouldn't share anything I didn't already know."
"I doubt you were very forthcoming yourself." She grimaces.
"No, but I'm used to making others compensate for me. He's smart, and that means it's going to be difficult to convince him that I want our alliance to work."
"So you do?"
"Thanks to your family, yes," she says. "You want to build a world for them, for your mother, for Kieran's children,
I understand that. When I chose to negotiate with the Sovereign, I was trying to do the same thing, protecting those I love. The Telemannises share a glance. Her finger traces dents in the table. I couldn't see a world without war unless we capitulated. Her eyes find my sigil-barren hands, searching the naked flesh there, as if it held the secret to all our futures. Maybe it does. But I can see one now. You really mean that? I ask. All of you.
Family is all that matters, Kavok says. And you are family.
Daxo sets an elegant hand on my shoulder. Even Sophocles seems to understand the gravity of the moment, resting his chin on my foot beneath the table.
Aren't you?
Yes. I nod gratefully. I am. With a tight smile, Mustang pulls a piece of paper from her pocket and slides it to me. That's Orion's comm frequency. I don't know where they are. Probably in the belt. I gave them a simple directive. Cause chaos. From what I've heard from Gold's chatter, they're doing just that. We'll need her and her ships if we're going to take down Octavia. Thank you, I say to them all. I didn't think we'd ever have a second chance. Nor did we, Daxo replies. Let me be blunt with you, Darrow. There is a matter of concern. It's your plan. You're designed to use claw drills to allow the Obsidians to invade key cities around Mars. We think it is a mistake. Really? I ask. Why? We need to wrest the Jackal's centers of power away, gain traction with the populace. Father and I do not have the same faith in the Obsidians you seem to have, Daxo says carefully. Your intentions will matter little if you let them loose on the populace of Mars.
Barbarians, Kavok says. They are barbarians.
Ragnar's sister is not Ragnar, Daxo replies. She's a stranger, and after hearing what she did to the Gold prisoners, we can't in good conscience join our forces to a plan that would unleash the Obsidians on the cities of Mars. The Arcos women won't either.
I see.
And there's another reason we think the plan flawed, Mustang says. It doesn't deal properly with my brother. Give my brother credit. He's smarter than you, smarter than me.
Even Kavax does not contest this.
Look what he's done. If he knows how to play the game, if he knows the variables, he'll sit in a corner for days, running through the possible moves, counter-moves, externalities and outcomes. That's his idea of fun. Before Claudius's death and before we were sent to live in different homes, he'd stay inside, rain or shine, and piece together puzzles, create mazes on paper, and beg me over and over again to try and find the center when I came back from riding with Father, or fishing with Claudius and Pax. And when I did find the center, he would laugh and say what a clever sister he had. I never thought much of it until I saw him afterward one day, alone in his room, when he thought no one was watching, shrieking and hitting himself in the face, punishing himself for losing to me. The next time he asked me to find the center of a maze, I pretended I couldn't, but he wasn't fooled. It was like he knew I'd seen him in his room. Not the introverted but pleasant, frail boy everyone else saw. The real him. She gathers her breath, shrugging away the thought. He made me finish the maze. And when I did, he smiled, said how clever I was, and walked off. The next time he drew a maze,
I couldn't find the center, no matter how hard I tried. She shifts uncomfortably. He just watched me try from the floor among his pencils, like an old evil ghost inside a little porcelain doll. That's how I remember him. It's how I see him now when I think about him killing Father. The Telemannuses listen with a foreboding silence, as afraid of the jackal as I am. Darrow, he'll never forgive you for beating him at the Institute, for making him cut off his hand. He'll never forgive me for stripping him naked and delivering him to you. We are his obsession, just as much as Octavia is, as much as Father was. So if you think he's going to just forget how Severo waltzed into his citadel with a claw drill and stole you from under him, you're going to get a lot of people killed. Your plan to take the cities won't work. He'll see it coming a kilometre off. And even if he doesn't, if we take Mars, this war will last for years. We need to go for the jugular. And not just that, Daxo says. We need assurances that you're not aiming to begin a dictatorship, or a full democracy in the case of victory. A dictatorship? I ask with a smirk. You really think I want to rule? Daxo shrugs. Someone must. A woman clears her throat at the door. We wheel around to see Holliday standing there with her thumbs in her belt loop. Sorry to interrupt, sir, but the Bologna is asking for you. It seems rather important. Chapter 37. The Last Eagle. Cassius lies handcuffed to the rails of the reinforced medical gurney in the center of the Sons of Ares infirmary. The same place I watched my people die from the wounds they suffered to save me from his clutches. Bed after bed of injured rebels from Phobos and other operations on the thermic fill the expanse. Ventilators whir and beep. Men cough. But it's the weight of the eyes that I feel most. Hands reach for me as I pass through the rows of cots and pallets lying on the floor. Mouths whisper my name. They want to touch my arms, to feel a human without sigils, without the mark of the masters. I let them as well as I can, but I haven't time to visit the fringes of the room. I asked Dancer to give Cassius a private room. Instead, he's been set smack in the middle of the main infirmary, among the amputees, adjacent to the huge plastic tent that covers the burn unit. There he can watch and be watched by the low colors, and feel the weight of this war the same way they do. I sense Dancer's hand at work here, giving Cassius equitable treatment. No cruelty, no consideration, just the same as the rest. I feel like buying the old socialist a drink. Several of Nero's boys, a grey and two weathered ex-hell divers, slump on metal chairs playing cards near Cassius's bedside. Heavy scorchers slung around their backs. They jump to their feet and salute as I approach. "Heard he's been asking for me," I say. "Most the night," the shorter of the Reds answers gruffly, eyeing Holliday behind me. "Wouldn't have bothered you, but he's a bloody damn Olympic. So thought we should pass the word up the chain." He leans so close I can smell the menthol of the synth tobacco between his stained teeth. "And the slagger says he's got information, sir."
"Can he talk?"
"Yeah," the soldier grumbles. "Doesn't say much, but the bolt's missed his box."
"I need to speak with him privately," I say.
"We got you covered, sir."
The doctor and the guards wheel Cassius's gurney to the far back of the room, to the pharmacy, which they keep guarded under lock and key. Inside, among the rows of plastic medication boxes, Cassius and I are left alone. He watches me from his bed, a white bandage around his neck, the faintest pinprick of blood dilating between his Adam's apple and the jugular on the right side of his throat. "It's a miracle you're not dead," I say. He shrugs. There's no tubes in his arms or morphine bracelet. I frown. "They didn't give you painkillers?"
"Not punishment. They voted."
He says very slowly, taking care not to rip the stitches on his neck.
"Wasn't enough morphine to go around. Low supplies. As they tell, the patients voted last week to give the hard meds to the burn victims and amputees. I'd think it noble if they didn't moan all night from pain, like lonely little puppies."
He pauses.
"I always wondered if mothers can hear their children weeping for them."
"Can yours?"
"I didn't weep. And I don't think my mother cares much for anything other than revenge. Whatever that means at this point."
"You said you had information," I ask. To business, because I don't know what else to say. I feel an ironclad kinship with this man. Severo asked why I saved him, and I could aspire to notions of valor and honor. But the deep spine reason is, I desperately want him to be a friend again. I crave his approval. Does that make me a fool? Disloyal? Is it the guilt speaking? Is it his magnetism? Or is it that vain part of me that just wants to be loved by the people I respect? And I do respect him. He has honor, a corrupted sort, but true honor nonetheless.
"Was it her or was it you?"
he asks carefully. "What do you mean?"
"Who kept the obsidians from boiling out my eyes and taking my tongue, you or Virginia?"
"It was both of us."
"Liar. Didn't think she'd shoot, to tell the truth of it."
He reaches up to feel his neck, but the manacles jerk his hands to a halt, startling him back into the room.
"Don't suppose you could take these off. It's dreadful when you've got an itch."
"I think you'll live." He chuckles as if saying he had to try.
"So, is this where you act morally superior for saving me? For being more civilized than gold?"
"Maybe I'm going to torture you for information," I say.
"Well, that's not exactly honorable."
"Neither is letting a man put me in a box for 9 months after torturing me for 3. Anyway, what the hell ever made you think I give a shit about being honorable?"
"True."
He frowns, creasing his brow and looking startling, like something Michelangelo would have carved.
"If you think the sovereign will barter, you're wrong. She won't sacrifice a single thing to save me."
"Then why serve her?" I ask.
"Duty."
He says the words, but I wonder how deeply he means them any longer. In his eyes I glimpse the loneliness, the longing for a life that should have been, and the glimmer of the man he wants to be, underneath the man he thinks he has to be. "All the same," I say, "I think we've done enough evil to one another. I'm not going to torture you. Do you have information, or are we just going to dance around it for another 10 minutes?
"Have you wondered yet why the Sovereign was suing for peace, Darrow? Surely it must have crossed your mind.
She's not one to dilute punishment unless she must. Why would she show leniency to Virginia? To the Rim? Her fleets outnumber those of the Moon Lord rebels 3-1. The Core is better supplied. Romulus can't match Roke. You know how good he is. So why would the Sovereign send us to negotiate? Why compromise?
I already know she wanted to replace the Jackal, I say. And she can't very well have a full-scale rebellion on the Rim while trying to cuff his ears and fight the Sons of Ares. She's trying to limit her theatres of war so she can focus all her weight on one problem at a time. It's not a complicated strategy.
But do you know why she wanted to remove him?
My escape, the camps, the disruptions in helium processing. I could list 100 reasons why installing a psychopath as arch-governor could prove burdensome.
All those are valid, he says, interrupting. Convincing, even. And they are the reasons we provided Virginia.
I step back toward him, hearing the implication in his voice. What didn't you tell her? He hesitates, as if wondering even now if he should tell me. Eventually, he does.
Earlier this year, our intelligence agents discovered discrepancies between the quarterly helium production logs reported to the Department of Energy and the Department of Mine Management, and the yield reports from our agents in mining colonies themselves. We found at least 125 instances where the Jackal falsely reported helium losses due to Sons of Ares disruption. Disruptions which didn't exist. He also claimed 14 mines destroyed by Sons of Ares attacks. Attacks which never happened.
So, he's skimming off the top, I say with a shrug. Hardly the first corrupt arch-governor in the world.
But he's not reselling it on the market,
Cassia says.
He's creating artificial shortages while he stockpiles.
Stockpiles? How much so far? I ask tensely.
With the surplus inventory from the 14 mines and the Martian reserve? At this rate, in 2 years he'll have more than the Imperial reserves on Luna and Venus and the war reserve on Ceres combined.
That could mean 100 things, I say quietly, realizing just how much fuel that is. 3/4 of the most valuable substance in the world, all under the control of one man. He's making a play for Sovereign. Buying senators?
40 so far, Cassius admits. More than we thought he had. But there's another kink which he's involved them in.
He tries to sit up straighter in his cot, but the manacles around his hands anchor him to a half-slouched pose.
I'm going to ask you a question, and I need you to tell me the truth.
I'd laugh at the idea if I didn't see how serious he is.
Did the Sons of Ares rob a deep space asteroid warehouse in March, several days after your escape? About 4 months ago.
Be more specific, I say.
A minor main belter in the Karin cluster, designation S1988, silicate-based junk asteroid, nearly zero mining potential. Specific enough?
I reviewed the entirety of Severo's tactical operations when I was making my recovery with Mickey. There were several assaults on Legion military bases within the asteroid belts, but nothing remotely like what Cassius is talking about. No, there were no operations on S1988 that I know of.
Gory damn,
he mutters under his breath.
Then we judged right.
What was in the warehouse? I ask. Cassius?
500 nuclear warheads,
he says darkly. The blood on his bandage has spread to the size of a gaping mouth.
500, I echo, my own voice a distant, hollow thing. What was their yield?
30 megatons each.
World killers. Cassius, why would they even exist?
In case the Ash Lord ever had to repeat Rhea, Cassius says. The depot lies between the core and the rim.
Repeat? Rhea?
That's who you serve, I ask. A woman who stores enough nuclear warheads to destroy a planet, just in case?
He ignores my tone. All evidence pointed to Ares, but the Sovereign thought it gave Severo too much credit. She had Moira investigated personally, and she was able to trace the tags of the hijacker's ship to a defunct shipping line formerly owned by Julii Industries.
If the Sons truly didn't steal them, then the Jackal has the weapons. But we don't know what he's doing with them.
I stand there, numb, mind racing to piece together how the Jackal might utilize so many atomics. According to the compact, the Martian military is only permitted 20 in its arsenal for ship-to-ship warfare, all under 5 megatons. If this is true, why would you tell me? I ask.
Because Mars is my home too, Darrow. My family has been there as long as yours. My mother is still there, in our home. Whatever the Jackal's long-term strategy is, the judgment of the Sovereign is that he will use the weapons here if his back is to the wall.
You're afraid we might win, I realize.
When it was Severo's war, no. The Sons of Ares was doomed. But now, look what's happening.
He looks me up and down.
We've lost containment. Octavia doesn't know where I am, whether or not Aja is alive. She has no eyes on this. The Jackal might know she tried to betray him to his sister. He's a wild dog. If you provoke him, he will bite.
He lowers his voice.
You might be able to survive that, Darrow. But can Mars?
Chapter 38. The Bill.
500 nuclear warheads,
Severo whispers. Holy bloody damn shit. Tell me you're joking. Go on. Dancer sits quietly at the war room table, kneading his temples.
It's bullshit,
Holiday grunts from the wall. If he has them, he'd have used them.
Let's leave the deductions to the individuals who have actually met the man, shall we?
Victor says. Adrius doesn't function like a normal human.
That's for damn sure,
Severo says.
Still, that's a solid question,
Dancer says, annoyed at the presence of so many golds, particularly Mustang, who stands beside me.
If he has them, why hasn't he used them?
Because that sort of escalation will hurt him almost as much as it hurts us, I say. And if he uses them, the Sovereign will have every excuse to replace him.
Oh, he doesn't have them,
Quicksilver says dismissively. He floats before us, blue hollow pixels shimmering over a display panel.
It's a ploy. Bellona knows what you care about, Darrow. He's plucking your heartstrings with notions of oblivion. It's bullshit. My techs would have seen major ripples if he was moving missiles, and I would have heard about plutonium enriching if the Sovereign had built them.
Unless they're old missiles, I say. Lots of relics lying about.
And it's a big solar system, Mustang says evenly.
I've got big ears, Quicksilver replies.
Had, Victor says. They're whittling them down as we speak.
The leaders of the rebellion sit in a semicircle in front of a holoprojector, which displays asteroid S1988. It's a barren hunk of rock, part of the Charon subfamily of the Coronis family of asteroids in the main belt between Mars and Jupiter. The Coronis asteroids are the base for heavy mining operations by an Earth-run energy consortium, and home to several disreputable astral way stations for smugglers and pirates, most notably 208 Lacrimosa, where Severo refueled on his journey from Pluto to Mars. The locals call the smuggler's cove Our Lady of Sorrows, where life is cheaper than a kilo of iced helium and a gram of demon dust, or so he says. He's unusually quiet about the place and his time there. Gold War Room meetings are held in circles or rectangles because people facing one another are more likely to engage in intellectual conflict than people sitting side by side. Golds relish that. I'm trying a different tack, having my friends face the problem, the holoprojector, so if they want to argue with one another, they have to crane their necks to do it. It's a shame we don't have the Sovereign's oracles, Mustang says. Strap one on his wrist and see how forthcoming Cassius really is.
Sorry we don't quite have the resources you're used to, Domina,
Dancer says.
That's not what I meant.
We could torture him,
Severo says. He's in the middle of the table, cleaning his fingernails with a blade. Victra leans against the wall behind him, flinching in annoyance with each flake of nail that falls onto the table. Dancer is to Severo's left. The meter-tall hologram of Quicksilver glows to his right, between us. Having declared Phobos a free city on behalf of the Rising, he functions as its governor, and now hunches over a small stack of thumb-sized heart oysters with a platinum octopus shucking knife, arranging the shells in five even mounds. If he's nervous about the Jackal's reprisals against his station, he doesn't look it. Sephi sweats underneath her tribal furs as she stalks along the perimeter of the table like a trapped animal, making Dancer shift in agitation.
You want the truth? Severo asks. Just give me 17 minutes and a screwdriver.
Should we really be having this talk with her here? Victor asks of Mustang.
She's on our side, I say. Are you sure?
Dancer asks.
She was crucial to recruiting the Obsidians, I say. She's connected us with Orion.
I made contact with the woman after speaking with Cassius. She's burning hard with the Pax and a sizable remnant of my old fleet to meet me.
Seems impossible I'd ever see the Ornery Blue again, or that ship which was the first place to feel like home since Lycos. Because of Mustang, we'll have a real navy. She preserved my command. She kept Orion at the helm. Would she have done that if she didn't have the same aims as us?
Which are? Dancer asks.
Defeating Loon and the Jackal, she says.
That's just the surface of what we want, Dancer says. She's working with us, I stress.
For now, Victor says. She's a clever girl. Maybe she wants to use us to eliminate her enemies, place herself in a position of power. Maybe she wants Mars. Maybe she wants more.
Seems only yesterday my Council of Golds was discussing whether or not Victra was worth trusting. Roke spoke up for her when no one else would.
The irony is apparently lost on Victra. Or maybe she remembers Mustang's vocal distrust of her intentions a year ago and has decided to repay the old debt.
I hate to agree with the Julii, Dancer says, but she's right in this. Augustans are players.
Not one's been born that hasn't been.
Apparently, Dancer wasn't impressed with Mustang's lack of transparency earlier. Mustang expected this. In fact, she asked to stay in her room, away from this, so she wouldn't detract from my plan. But in order for this to work, in order for there to be some way to piece things together in the end, there must be cooperation. They expect me to defend Mustang, which shows how little they know her.
You are all being rather illogical, Mustang says. I don't mean that as an insult, but simply as a statement of fact. If I meant you ill, I would have hailed the Sovereign or my brother and brought a tracking device on my ship. You know what lengths she would go to in order to find Tino's.
My friends exchanged troubled glances. But I didn't. I know you will not trust me, but you trust Darrow, and he trusts me. And since he knows me better than any of you do, I think he's in the best position to make the call. So stop whimpering like gory damn children, and let's be about the task, eh?
If you have a buzzsaw, I could do it in around 3 minutes,
Severo says.
Will you shut the hell up?
Dancer barks at him. It's the first time I've ever seen him lose his temper.
A man will lie through his teeth, say whatever you want to hear if you're pulling off his toenails. It doesn't work.
He was tortured himself by the Jackal, just like Evie and Harmony were. Severo crosses his arms.
Well, that's an unfair and massive generalization, Gramps. We don't torture,
Dancer says.
That's final.
Oh, yeah, right, Severo says.
We're the good guys. Good guys never torture, and always win. But how many good guys get their heads put in boxes? How many get to watch their friends' spines cut in half?
Dancer looks to me for help.
Darrow.
Quicksilver pops open an oyster.
Torture can be effective, if done correctly, with confirmable information in a narrow scope. Like any tool, it is not a panacea. It must be used properly. Personally, I don't really think we have the luxury of drawing moral lines in the sand. Not today. Let Barker have a go. Pull some nails. Some eyes, if need be.
I agree,
Theodora says, surprising the council.
What about Mateo?
I ask Quicksilver.
Severo shattered his face.
Quicksilver's knife slips on the new oyster, punching into the meat of his palm. He winces and sucks at the blood.
And if he hadn't have passed out, he would have told you where I was. From my experience, pain is the best negotiator.
I agree with them, Darrow,
Mustang says. We have to be certain he's telling the truth. Otherwise, we're letting him dictate our strategy, which is classic counterintelligence on his part. It's what you would do. And it's what I tried to do till the torture started with the Jackal. Victra, who has been silent on the issue till now, walks abruptly around the table into the hollow projection so that black space and stars play along her skin. Jagged, white-blonde hair drifts in front of angry eyes as she pulls her grey shirt off. She's muscled and lithe beneath, and wears a compression bra. A half-dozen razor scars stretch 3 inches at a diagonal across her flat belly. There's more than a dozen on her sword arm, a few on her face, neck, clavicle.
Some I'm proud of,
she says of the scars.
Some I'm not.
She turns to show us her lower back. It's a waxy, melted swath of flesh where her sister left her mark in acid. She turns back to us, raising her chin in defiance.
I came here because I didn't have a choice. I stayed when I did. Don't make me regret that.
It's startling to see the vulnerability in her.
I don't think Mustang would ever let her guard down in public like this. Severo stares intensely at the tall woman as she tugs her shirt back on and turns back to the hollow. She reaches for the asteroid with both hands to stretch the hologram.
"Can we get better resolution?"
she asks, as if the matter is settled. "The picture was taken by a Census Bureau drone," I say, "nearly 70 years ago. We don't have access to the current society military records."
"My men are on it," Quicksilver says, "but they're not optimistic. We're fighting a legion of society counterattacks right now. Gory damn maelstrom." "This is when having your father around would come in handy," Severo says to Mustang.
"He never mentioned anything like this to me," she replies.
"Mother did once,"
Victor says thoughtfully.
"Antonia and I. Something about nasty little goodie bags that Imperators could collect on the fly if the rim went off the tracks."
That matches with what Cassia says. She turns back to us.
"I think Cassius is telling the truth."
"So do I," I say to the group. "And torturing him doesn't resolve anything. Cut off his fingers one by one, and what if he still says it's true? Do we keep cutting until he says it's not? Either way, it's a gamble." I get a few reluctant nods and feel relief that at least one battle's won, if a little wary knowing how savage my friends can become.
"What did he suggest we do?"
Dancer asks.
"I'm sure he had a proposal."
"He wants me to have a holo conference with the Sovereign," I say.
"Why?"
"To discuss an alliance against the Jackal. They give us intel, we kill him before he can detonate any bombs," I say.
"That's his plan."
Severo giggles. "Sorry. Well, that would be bloody damn fun to watch." He pulls up his left hand and makes a talking motion with it.
"Hello, you old rusty bitch. You recall when I kidnapped your grandchild?"
He pulls up his right hand.
"Why, yes, my goodman, just after I enslaved your entire race."
He shakes his head.
"No purpose in talking to that pixie. Not until we're knocking on her doorstep with a fleet. You should send me and the Howlers after good old Jackal. Can't press a button without a head."
"The Valkyrie will attend this mission with the Howlers,"
Seffi says.
"No, the Jackal will invite a personal attack," I say, glancing at Mustang, who has already warned me off that course. "He knows us too well to be surprised by things we've done in the past. I'm not throwing lives away by playing into his understanding of our strengths."
"Do you have anyone inside his inner circle, Regulus?" Dancer asks Quicksilver. Surprisingly, the two men seem to rather like one another.
"I did, until your Greys broke Darrow out. Adrius had his chief of intelligence purge his inner circle. My men are all dead, or imprisoned, or scared shitless."
"What do you think, Augustus?"
Dancer asks Mustang. All eyes turn to her. She takes her time in replying.
"I think the reason you've managed to stay alive so long is because Goals are so consumed with the individual ego that they've forgotten how they conquered Earth. Each thinks they can rule. With Orion returning and Severo's gains, your greatest strength now lies with your navy and an obsidian army. Don't help the Sovereign. She is still the most dangerous enemy. You help her, she focuses on you. Sow more seeds of discord."
Dancer nods in agreement. "But are we sure the Jackal would actually use the nukes on the planet?"
"The only thing my brother ever wanted was my father's approval. He did not get it. So he killed my father. Now he wants Mars. What do you think he'll do if he doesn't get it?"
A menacing silence fills the room.
"I have a new plan," I say.
"I should bloody damn hope so," Severo mutters to Victor.
Do I get to hide inside anything? I'm sure we can find something for you, darling, she says.
I nod my agreement. He waves a hand.
Well, then let's hear it, Reaper.
Hypothetically, assume we can take half the cities of Mars. I say, standing and summoning a graphic from the table that shows a red tide flowing over the globe of Mars, claiming cities, pushing back the golds. Say we crush the Jackal's fleet in orbit when Orion joins us, even though we are outnumbered 2-1. Say we shatter his armies. With the Valkyrie's help, we fracture the Obsidians away from the legions and have them join us. And we have a groundswell from the populace itself. The machines of industry grind to a complete halt on Mars. We've rebuffed the society's countless reinforcements, and we have insurrection in every street, and we have cornered the Jackal after years of warfare. And it will take years. What happens then?
The machines of industry don't stop off of Mars, Victor says. They keep rolling, and they'll keep pumping men and material here.
Or, I say, he uses the bombs, Dancer says, which I also believe he'll use on the Obsidians and our army if we go ahead with Operation Rising Tide, I say. We've been prepping the operation for months, Dancer protests. With the Obsidians, it might just work. You want to scrap it? Yes, I say. This planet is why we fight. The strength of rebel armies throughout history is that they have less to protect. They can rove and move and are impossible to pin down. We have so much to lose here, so much to protect. This war won't be won in days or weeks. It will be a decade. Mars will bleed, and at the end, ask yourselves, what will we inherit? A corpse of what was once our home. We must fight this war, but I will not fight it here. I propose we leave Mars. Quicksilver coughs.
Leave Mars?
Sephi steps forward from the shadows of the stone room.
You said you would protect my people.
Our strength is here, in the tunnels, Dancer continues. In our population. That's where our responsibility lies, Darrow. He glances at Mustang, his suspicions clear.
Don't forget where you come from, why you're doing this.
I have not forgotten, Dancer.
Are you so sure? This war is for Mars.
It's for more than that, I say.
For low colors, he continues, voice gaining volume. Win here and then spread across the society. It's where the helium is. It is the heart of the society, of red. Win here, then spread. That's how Ares intended it.
This war is for everyone, Mustang corrects.
No, Dancer says territorially. This is our war, Gold. I was fighting it when you were still learning how to enslave human beings at your...
Severo looks at me in annoyance as our friends descend into bickering. I give him a little nod and he pulls his razor and slams it into the table. It cuts halfway through and trembles there.
Reaper's trying to speak, you shit gobblers. Besides... all this colorism bores me.
He looks around, terribly pleased with the silence. He nods to himself and waves a theatrical hand.
Reaper, please, continue. You are getting to the exciting part.
Thank you, Severo. I won't fall into the trap of the Jackal, I say. The easiest way to lose any war is to let the enemy dictate the terms of engagement. We must do the thing the Jackal and the Sovereign least expect of us. Create our own paradigm so they're playing our game, reacting to our decisions. We must be bold. Right now, we've sparked a fire, rebellions in almost all society territories.
We stay here. That means we are contained. I will not be contained.
I transfer the image on my datapad to the table so that the hologram of Jupiter floats in the air. 63 tiny moons dot the periphery, but the four great Jovian moons dominate its orbit. These four largest, Ganymede, Callisto, Io, and Europa, are referred to collectively as Ilium. Around those moons are two of the largest fleets in the solar system, that of the Moon Lords and that of the Sword Armada. Severo looks so pleased he might faint. I'm giving him the war he didn't even know he wanted. The civil war between Bellona and Augustus has exposed larger fault lines between the core and the outer rim. Octavia's main fleet, the Sword Armada, is hundreds of millions of kilometers away from its nearest support. Excepting the Scepter Armada around Luna, it is the greatest weapon Octavia has. Octavia sent our good friend Roque Au Fabii to bring the Moon Lords to heel. He has shattered every fleet that has been thrown against them, even with the help of Mustang, the Telemannuses, and the Arcoses, he has beaten the Rim down. On board these ships are more than 2 million men and women, more than 10,000 Obsidian, 200,000 Greys, 3,000 of the greatest killers alive, Peerless Scarred, Praetors, Legates, Knights, Squad Commanders, the greatest golds of their institutes. This fleet has been reinforced by Antonia Aus Severus Julii, and it is the instrument of fear by which the Sovereign binds the planets to her will. It, like its commander, has never been defeated. I pause, allowing the words to sink in so they all know the gravity of my proposal. In 40 days, we're going to destroy the Sword Armada and rip the beating heart out of the Society war machine. I pull Severo's razor out of the table and toss it back to him. Now, I'll take your bloody damn questions.
Chapter 39. The Heart. Dancer finds me as I make final preparations to board the shuttle with Severo and Mustang that will lead us to the fleet in orbit. Tinos swarms with activity. Hundreds of shuttles and transports gathered by Dancer and his Sons of Ares leadership depart through the great tunnels to make their migration toward the South Pole, where they will still ferry the Obsidian young and old from their home to the safety of the mines. But the warriors will go to orbit to join my fleet. In 24 hours they will move 800,000 human beings in the greatest effort in Sons of Ares history. It makes me smile thinking how much happier Fitchner would be, knowing the greatest endeavor of his legacy was to save lives instead of to take them. After covering the evacuation with the fleet, I will burn hard for Jupiter. Dancer and Quicksilver will remain behind to continue what they started and hold the Jackal on Mars till the next evolution of the plan begins. It's haunting, isn't it? Dancer says, watching the sea of blue engine flares that flow past our stalactite up to the great tunnel in the ceiling of Tinos. Victra stands closely with Severo at the edge of the open hangar, two dark silhouettes watching the hope of two peoples float away into the darkness. The Red Armada goes to war. Dancer breathes. Never thought I'd see the day. Fitchner should be here, I reply. Yes, he should, Dancer grimaces. It's my greatest regret, I think, that he couldn't live to see his son wear his helm. And you become what he always knew you to be. And what's that? I ask, watching a red howler jump twice with his grav boots and rocket off the edge of the hangar to enter the open cargo hatch of a passing troop carrier. Someone who believes in the people, he says delicately. I turn to face Dancer, glad that he sought me out in my last moments here among my kin. I don't know if I'll ever return. and if I do, I fear he will see me as a different man. One who betrayed him, our people, Io's dream. I've been here before, saying goodbye on a landing pad. Harmony stood with him then. Mickey, too, as they said goodbye on that spire in Yorkton. How can I feel so melancholy for so terrible a past? Maybe that's just the nature of us, ever wishing for things that were and could be, rather than things that are and will be. It takes more to hope than to remember. Do you think the Moon Lords will really help us? He asks. No. The trick will be making them think they're helping themselves, then getting out before they turn on us.
It's a risk, boy. But you like those, don't you?
I shrug. It's also the only chance we have. Boots clomp on the metal deck behind me. Holiday moves past, up the ramp, carrying a bag of gear with several new howlers. Life moves on, carrying me with it. It's been nearly 7 years since Dancer and I met, yet it seems 30 on him. How many decades of war has he faced? How many friends has he said goodbye to that I've never known, that he's never even mentioned? People who he loved as much as I love Severo and Ragnar. He had a family once, though he rarely speaks of them now. We all had something once. We're each robbed and broken in our own way. That's why Fichtner formed this army, not to piece us together, but to save himself from the abyss his wife's death opened in him. He needed a light, and he made it. Love was his shout into the wind. Same with my wife. Lorne once told me, if he had been my father, he would have raised me to be a good man. There's no peace for great men, he said. I smile at the memory. I should have asked him who he thinks makes the peace for all those good men. You are a good man, Dancer tells me. My hands are scarred and brutal things. When I clench them, their knuckles turn that familiar shade of white. Yeah, I grin. Then why do I want to do bad things? He laughs at that, and I surprise him by pulling him into a hug. His good arm wraps around my hips, his head barely coming to my chest. Severo might have worn the helmet, but you're the heart here, I tell him. You always have been. You're too humble to see it, but you're as great a man as Ares himself. And somehow you're still good. Unlike that dirty rat bastard. I pull back and thump his chest. And I love you. Just so you know. Oh, bloody damn. He mutters, eyes tearing up. I thought you were a killer. You gone soft on me, boy? Never, I say, winking. He pushes me off. Go say goodbye to your mother before you go. I leave him to shout at a group of Sun's Marines and work my way through the bustle, bumping fists with Pebble, who Screwface pushes on a wheelchair toward a boarding ramp, tossing a salute to Sons of Ares I recognize, talking shit back to Uncle Nerol, who walks with a troop of pit vipers. They're destined for a sabotage mission against the Jackal's deep space communication relays. My mother and Mustang stop talking abruptly when I arrive. Both look distraught. What's the matter? I ask. Just saying goodbye, Mustang says. My mother steps close to me. Dio brought this from Lycos. She opens a little plastic box and shows me the dirt inside. My little mother smiles up at me. You fly in tonight, and when all grows dark, remember who you are. Remember, you are never alone. The hopes and dreams of our people go with you. Remember home.
She pulls me down to kiss my forehead. Remember, you are loved. I hug her tight and pull back to see she has tears in her hard eyes. I'll be all right, Ma, I say.
I know.
I know you don't think you deserve to be happy, she says. But you do, child. You deserve it more than anyone I know. So do what you need to do, then come home to me. She takes my hand and Mustang's. Both of you, come home. Then start living. I leave her behind, confused and emotional.
What was that about?
I ask Mustang.
Mustang looks at me as if I should know.
She's afraid.
Why?
She's your mother.
I walk up my shuttle's landing pad with Severo and Victra, who join Mustang and I at the bottom.
Hell diver!
Dancer shouts before we reach the top. I turn back to find the gnarled man with his fist thrust in the air, and behind him, the whole of the stalactite hangar watches me. Hundreds of deckhands on mechanized loading trams, pilots, blue and red and green, who stand at the ramps of their ships, or on the ladders leading into their cockpits, helmets in hands, platoons of greys and reds and obsidians standing side by side, carrying combat gear and supplies, the scythe sewn onto shoulders, painted onto faces, as they board shuttles bound for my fleet. Men and women of Mars all, fighting for something larger than themselves. For our planet. For their people. I feel the weight of their love. I feel the hopes of all those people in bondage who watched as the sons of Ares rose to take Phobos. We promised them something, and now we must deliver. One by one, my army raises their hands till a sea of fists clench, as Eos did when she held the Himanthus and fell before Augustus. Chills run through me as Severo and Victra and Mustang and even my mother raise their hands in union.
Break the chains!
Dancer bellows. I raise my own scarred fist and step silently into the shuttle to join the Red Armada as it sails to war. Chapter 40. Yellow Sea.
The Yellow Sea of Io rolls in around my black boot. Great dunes of sulfur-laced sand with razorback ridges of silicate rock as far as the eye can see. In the steel-blue sky, the marbled surface of Jupiter undulates. 130 times the diameter that Luna appears from the surface of Earth, it seems the vast and evil head of a marble god. War grips it 67 moons. Cities hunker under pulse shields. Blackened husks of men in star shells litter moons, while fighter squadrons duel and hunt troop and supply transports among the faint ice rings of the gas giant. It's quite a sight. I stand upon the dune, flanked by Sephi and five Valkyrie in black pulse armor, waiting for the Moon Lord's shuttle. Our assault ship sits behind us, engines idling. It's shaped like a hammerhead shark, dark grey. But the Valkyrie and red dockworkers painted its head together on our journey from Mars, giving the ship two bulging blue eyes and a gaping mouth with ravenous blood-stained teeth. Up between the eyes, Holiday lies on her belly, sniper rifles scanning the rock formations to the south.
Anything?
I ask, voice crackling through the breathing mask.
Nothing,
Severo says over the comm. He and Clown scout the little settlement two clicks away on grav boots. I can't see them with the naked eye. I fidget with my sling blade.
They'll come, I say. Mustang set the time and place.
Io is a strange moon. innermost and smallest of the four great Galilean moons, she is a belt notch larger than Luna. It was never her destiny to be fully changed by the gold's terraforming machines. She's a hell Dante could be proud of. The driest object in the Sol system, rife with explosive volcanism and sulfur deposits and interior tidal heating. Her surface a canvas of yellow and orange plains, broken by huge thrust faults from her shifting surface. Dramatic sheer cliffs rising from the sulfur dunes to scrape the sky. Huge stains of concentric green freckle her equatorial regions. Finding crops and animals difficult to cultivate so far from the sun, the Society Engineering Corps covered millions of acres of Io surface with pulse fields, imported dirt and water for three lifetimes on cosmos haulers, thickened the planet's atmosphere to filter Jupiter's massive radiation, and used the planet's interior tidal heating to power great generators to grow foodstuffs for the entire Jupiter orbit and exportation to the core, and, more importantly, the rim. She's a farm deck, with the biggest breadbasket between Mars and Uranus, with easy gravity and cheap land. Guess who did all the labor? Beyond the pulse fields is the Sulphur Sea, stretching from pole to pole, interrupted only by volcanoes and lakes of magma. I may not like Io, but I can respect the people of this land. Ionian men and women are not like humans of Earth or Luna or Mercury or Venus. They are harder, lither, eyes slightly larger to absorb the dimmed light 600 million kilometers from the sun, skin pale, taller, and able to withstand higher doses of radiation. These people believe themselves most like the Iron Golds who conquered Earth and put man at peace for the first time in her history. I shouldn't have worn black today. My gloves, my cloak, my jacket underneath. I thought we were going to the anti-Jupiter side of Io, where sulfur dioxide snowfields crust the planet. But the Moon Lord's operation team demanded a new meeting point at the last moment, setting us on the edge of the Sulphur Sea. Temperature, 120 degrees Celsius. Sefi walks up to stand beside me with her new optics scanning the yellow horizon. She and her Valkyrie have taken quickly to the gear of war, studying and training day and night with holiday during our month-and-a-half journey to Jupiter, practicing shipboarding and energy weapon tactics, as well as grey hand signals. "How's the heat?" I ask. "Strange," she says. "Only her face can feel it. The rest benefits from the cooling systems and the armor. Why would people live here?" "We live everywhere we can." "But golds choose," she says. "Yes?" "Yes. I would be wary, men who choose such a home. The spirits here are cruel." Sand kicks up from the wind in the low gravity, floating down in wavering columns. It's Sefi who Mustang thinks I should be wary of. On our journey to Jupiter, she has watched hundreds of hours of holo footage, learning our history as a people. I keep track of her datapad's activity. But what concerns Mustang isn't that Sefi is fond of rainforest videos and experientials, but that she has spent countless hours watching holos of our wars, particularly the nuclear annihilation of Rhea. I wonder what she makes of it. "Sound advice, Sefi," I reply. "Sound advice." Severo lands dramatically before us, spraying us with sand. His ghost cloak ripples away. "Bloody damn shithole." I dust off my face, annoyed. He was incorrigible the whole journey out here, laughing, pulling pranks, and slipping off to Victra's room whenever he thought no one was looking. Ugly little man's in love. And for what it's worth, it seems to go both ways. "What do you think?" I ask. "The whole place smells like farts." "That's your professional assessment?" Holiday asks over the comm. "Yep. There's a Wagar settlement over the ridge." He His howler wolf pelt kicks in the wind, jingling the little chains that connect it to his armor.
Bunch of red-hunched goggleheads carting distillation gear.
You've scanned the sand? I ask.
Ain't my first slag, boss. I don't like this face-to-face bullshit, but it looks clear.
He glances at his data pad.
Thought Moonies were supposed to be punctual. Pricklicks are 30 minutes late.
Probably cautious. Must think we've air support, I say.
Yeah, because we'd be bloody damn shitbrains for not bringing some.
Roger that, Holliday says in agreement over the comm.
Why would I need air support when I've got you, I say, gesturing to Severo's grav boots.
A plastic grey case sits on the ground behind him. Inside, a Sarissa missile launcher in foam padding. The same Ragnar used on Cassius's craft. If the need arises, I've got myself a psychotic goblin-sized fighter jet.
Mustang said they'll be here, I say.
Mustang said they'll be here,
Severo mocks in childish voice.
They better. Fleet can't squat for long out there without being spotted.
My fleet waits with Orion in orbit since Mustang took her shuttle to Nessus, the capital of Io. 50 torch ships and destroyers hunkered down, shields off, engines dark, on the barren moon of Sinope, as the larger fleets of the Golds swim through space, closer in to the Galilean moons. Any closer, and the Gold sensors will pick us up. But as it hides, my fleet is vulnerable. With one pass, a measly squadron of ripwings could destroy it.
The Moonies will come, I say.
But I'm not sure of it. They're a cold, proud, insular people, these Jovian Golds. Roughly 8,000 peerless scarred call the Galilean moons of Jupiter home. Their institutes are all out here, and it is only societal service, or vacations for the wealthiest among them, that takes them to the core. Luna might be the ancestral home of their people, but it's alien to most of them. Metropolitan Ganymede is the center of their world.
The Sovereign knows the danger of having an independent rim. She spoke to me of the difficulty of imposing her power across 1 billion kilometers of empire.
Her true fear was never Augustus and Bellona destroying one another. It was the chance that the rim would rebel and cut the society in half. 60 years ago, at the beginning of her reign, she had the Ash Lord nuke Saturn's moon, Rhea, when its ruler refused to accept her authority. That example held for 60 years. But 9 days after my triumph, the children of the Moon Lords, who were kept on Luna in the Sovereign's court as insurance towards their parents' political cooperation, escaped. They were assisted by Mustang's spies, which she left behind in the Citadel. 2 days after that, the heirs of the fallen Arch-Governor Rivas Aura, who was killed at my triumph, stole or destroyed the entirety of the societal garrison fleet in its dock at Callisto. They declared Io's independence and pressured the other more populous and powerful moons into joining them. Soon after, the infamously charismatic Romulus Aura was elected sovereign of the Rim. Saturn and Uranus joined soon after that, and the second moon rebellion began 60 years, 211 days after the first. The Moon Lords obviously expected the Sovereign would find herself mired on Mars for a decade, maybe longer. Add to that a certain low-color insurrection in the core, and one can see why they assumed she would not be able to devote the resources needed to send a fleet of sufficient size, 600 million kilometers, to quash their nascent rebellion. They were wrong.
We've got inbound, Pebble says from her station at the shuttle sensor boards. 3 ships, 290 clicks out.
Finally, Severo mutters. Here come the bloody damn Moonies.
3 warships emerge from the heat mirage on the horizon. 2 black Sarpedon-class fighters, painted with the four-headed white dragon of Ra, clutching a Jovian thunderbolt in its talons,
escort a fat, tan, Priam-class shuttle. The ship lands before us. Dust swirls, and the ramp unfurls from the belly of the craft. Seven lithe forms, taller and lankier than I, walk down into the sand. Golds, all. They wear krill, organic breathing masks made by carvers over nose and mouths. Looks like the shed skin of a locust, legs stretching to either ear. Their tan combat gear is lighter than core armor, and complemented with brightly colored scarves. Long-barreled railguns with personalized ivory stocks are strapped to their backs. Razors hang from their hips. Orange optics cover their eyes, and on their feet are skippers. Lightweight boots that use condensed air instead of gravity to move their user, skipping them over the ground like stones on a lake. Can't get much height, but you can move nearly 60 kilometers an hour. They're about a quarter the weight of my boots, have battery life for a year, and are dead cold on thermal vision. These are assassins, not knights. Holiday recognizes the different breed of danger.
"She's not with them," she says over her comm. "Any telemanuses?"
"No," I say. "Hold, I see her." Mustang steps out of the craft, joining the much taller Ionians. She's dressed like them, except without a rifle. Joined by another Ionian woman, this one with the forward-hunching shoulders of a cheetah, Mustang joins us atop the dune. The rest of the Ionians stay near the ship. Not a threat, just an escort.
"Darrow," Mustang says. "Sorry we're late."
"Where's Romulus?" I ask.
"He's not coming."
"Bullshit," Severo hisses.
"I told you, Reap."
"Severo, it's fine," Mustang says. "This is his sister, Vila."
The tall woman stares down her smashed flat nose at us. Her skin is pale, body adapted for the low gravity. It's hard to see her face past the mask and goggles, but she seems in her early 50s. Her voice is one even note. "I send my brother's greetings and welcome, Darrow of Mars. I am Legate Vila Aura." Sephi slinks around us, examining the alien gold and the strange gear she carries. I like the way people talk when Sephi circles. Seems a little more honest. "Well met, Legatus." I nod cordially. "Will you be speaking for your brother? I'd hoped to make my case in person." The skin to the side of her goggles crinkles. "No one speaks for my brother, not even I. He wishes for you to join him at his private home on the wastes of Karak."
"So you can lure us into a trap?" Severo asks. "Better idea. How about you tell your bitch of a brother to honor his bloody dumb agreement before I take that rifle and shove it so far up your fartle you look like a skinny pixie's shish kebab?"
"Severo, stop," Mustang says. "Not here, not these people."
Vila watches Sephi circle, taking note of the razor on the huge obsidian's hip.
"I could give a shit and piss who this is. She knows who we are. And she ain't got a little trickle going down her leg, standing toe-to-toe with the bloody damn Reaper of Mars. Then she's got less brains than a wad of ass lint."
"He cannot come," Vila says.
"Understandable," I reply. Severo makes a grotesque motion.
"What is that?"
Vila asks, nodding to Sephi. "That is a queen," I say. "Sister to Ragnar Valarus." Vila is wary of Sephi, as well she should be. Ragnar is a name known.
"She cannot come either. But I was speaking in regards to that hunk of metal you flew here on. Is it meant to be a ship?"
She snorts and turns up her nose. "Built on Venus, obviously."
"It's borrowed," I say. "But if you care to make an exchange..."
Vila surprises me with a laugh, before becoming serious once more.
"If you wish to present yourself to Moon Lords as a diplomatic party, then you must show respect for my brother,
and trust the honour of his hospitality.
I've seen enough men and women set aside honour when it's inconvenient, I say probingly.
In the core, perhaps. This is the rim, Vila replies. We remember the ancestors. We remember how iron gold should be. We do not murder guests like that bitch on Luna, or like that jackal on Mars.
Yet, I say.
Vila shrugs. It is a choice you must make, Reaper. You have 60 seconds to decide.
Vila steps away as I confer with Mustang and Severo. I motion Sefi over.
Thoughts?
Romulus would rather die than kill a guest, Mustang says. I know you don't have any reason to trust these people, but honour actually means something to them. It's not like the Bologna who just tossed the word around. Adhera, Gold's word means as much as his blood.
Do you know where the residence is? I ask.
She shakes her head. If I did, I'd take you there myself. They've got equipment inside to check for radiation and electronic trackers. They've studied you. We'll be on our own.
Lovely.
But this isn't about tactics. No short-term gain here. My big play was coming out to the rim knowing I had leverage the Sovereign doesn't. That leverage will keep my head on my shoulders better than anyone's honour. Yet, I've been wrong before. So I double-check and listen now.
Do the rules governing treatment of guests extend to Reds? Severo asks. Or just Golds? That's what we need to know.
I glance back at Vila. It's a fair point. If he kills you, he kills me, Mustang says. I'm not leaving your side, and if he does that, my men turn against him. The Telemannuses turn against him. Even Lorne's daughter-in-law will turn against him. That's nearly a third of his navy. It's a blood feud he can't afford.
Sefi, what do you think?
She closes her eyes, so her blue tattoos can see the spirits of this waste.
Go.
Give us 6 hours, Severo. If we're not back by then, wank off in the bushes. Lay waste. Can do. He bumps my fist with his and winks. Happy diplomacy, kids. He keeps his fist out for Mustang. You too, horsey. We're in this shit together, eh? She happily bumps his knuckles with her own.
Bloody damn right.